Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Estina number 21. Today is August 19th, year of our Lord 2008. And today we're going to talk about a number of different things. But we'll start off by talking about a copy of the letter from Simon Shepherd. And these are our British friends who are in jail for speaking their mind in Britain. And I'm embarrassed to say I have not written them yet. I hope that some of you have. But I'm going to go ahead and write them this week. But what I got was more or less, not precisely a press release, but a two-page explanation of the basis for their asylum claim. And this would be Stephen Whittle, who writes under the name Luke O'Farrell, and also Simon Shepherd, who's the host of Heretical.com, based on a U.S. server. And we'll see just how tyrannical Britain's become when we read this. We're also going to talk today about, and instead of the Jones and from the book, we're going to do Jones from the latest Culture Wars magazine. That's E. Michael Jones, CultureWars.com, Catholic. And I've read more of Chapter 4 of his latest book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, but I didn't find anything I particularly wanted to talk about. So what we're going to do instead is talk about Marcus Garvey and black nationalism and how the Jews co-opted black nationalism in the U.S. to use it to push for integration, which would protect their own civil rights while enslaving the white man by destroying his safety and his mental equanimity by introducing violent Negroes to his community. So it's an exciting and negative tale from the first couple of decades of the 20th century. Let's see. Now, we'll go for at least a couple of hours today, depending on how much we get into it. There's a lot of different stuff to talk about. We've also upgraded the forum. We've created a tarred corral. We've put in the troublemakers into the corral where we can mess with them, but they can't mess with us. We're looking for intelligent people, people who know the difference between plurals and possessive, who know ITS, there, all that stuff. We don't need any more retards. There's enough retards out there. What we've also done, I spent all Sunday going through the crime section. It used to be the black on white crime archive. Now it's just crime. We've got sticky to a number of different things. One thing you find if you do interviews with the media or you talk to liberals, they will always say that whites are disproportionately child molesters and serial killers, but in fact that's not the case. So what we've done, what we're doing is populating that forum, that crime forum, with blacks, with different sticky threads featuring black serial killers. That one's not fleshed out fully yet. We've got Coral Eugene Watts and another guy in there right now, but I know there's a long list of them that will get in there. But I went through the pages of that forum and took all the what we call hush crimes, crimes covered up by the Jew media, that is black or brown on white, and those are all in a list, chronological list, with the most recent at the top. Going all the way back to the 80s, and we have another fellow who's helping out with that, going through the threads in the main news forums. So, the crime has been updated. Pretty much we're totally up to speed. We've also got a new genealogy forum. Rounder was posting some stuff about his ancestors who fought with the Confederates. And I dug up a little from a different one of my uncle's books about Linders, who were mostly Union, and then a couple fought with the South. But anyway, there's a new subforum called Genealogy you can post that type of material in. Yeah, I think the reorganization has really showed, you know, which people are there to cause trouble and be paranoid and whatever. And Tard Corral's kind of a reverse halfway house. You're in the Tard Corral and you end up back in jail rather than back in general society, with the possible exception of one or two who might be stuck in there as a penalty. You know, Lord Acton said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And let me tell you, a little taste of exercising power in the forum. I'm not saying it's going to my head. I'm just saying I'm getting awfully familiar with that button to throw people into the Tard Corral. I got to admit, it's a lot of fun. I threw Hal in there yesterday. His most recent was, although he's formally gone, he is basically claiming that he was He knew that guy who, what was his name, Guatney. He knew the guy, Tim Johnson or something, who killed Guatney. You know, this kind of garbage where people go out and make these bogus assertions. There's no need for that. I don't want that at VNN. It's got to be fact-based. It's got to be hardcore. It's got to be properly edited. Enough about the forum for now. Now, what we want to get on to here, we'll probably go 2-3 hours, maybe one song break in the middle. This Garvey stuff is fascinating. You're going to find out just how treacherous the Jews are. And, you know, that's kind of the theme of VNN. We are whites. They are Jews. Those are the two forces doing battle. We'll talk about that. What I want to get through today is talking about not only the updates, which we've just done for the forum, we're going to do for Simon Shepherd, and I encourage people to write. I'm going to give you the address in a couple minutes, so grab a pencil and write this down. It's also at vnnforum.com, a couple of different places in there if you do a search on Simon Shepherd. But I want to get to, we had some fights in the people going off and saying I acted the wrong way in Knoxville. I want to talk a little more, and probably I've talked about it in the past. I've just been so taken up with my health, I've forgotten some of the stuff I talked about earlier. But I want to, it can't hurt to re-hit it. And the arrangement that society has made to present the illusion of free speech, but the reality of ziplocking anybody who has something substantial to say. I think we got into it last time a little. We're talking about the homosexuals in San Francisco filleting each other in public, allowed to mix with the public. I mean, all too literally, mixed bodily fluids with the public, whereas we in Knoxville were sealed off from the people. So we'll talk about that at the end, but that'll probably be the last hour because I want to spend at least an hour in the Garvey, probably a little longer. Okay. Yeah, so I got three things in the agenda today apart from the small stuff. The one is the Black Nationals, and the two is the rallies and the rest. Three is talk a little bit about Kirksville and just further signs of decline. And Kirksville being a small town in northeastern Missouri that's more or less representative of your small town, wherever you are. We'll talk about the real-world implications of this integration the Jews foisted on us as a communist revolution while calling it civil rights. And that will be the third topic. So we'll talk about the decline of Kirksville. We'll talk about, I'd say decline yet, but symptoms of problems associated with bigger cities. We'll talk about what the Mexicans have been up to. We'll talk about rallies, and we'll talk about Black nationalism. Now let me read you Stephen Shepherd's letter and encourage you to write him, as I will this week. And he and Luke Whittle are both at the jail, but the address I have in front of me, I'm going to give you the address right now. Simon Shepherd, SimonSheppard, and I will put this, I know it's already at vnnforum.com, which we encourage you to join. It's there in a couple of different threads. I'll put it also in the under Broadcasting Radio Astina, this show. I'll post it with the show notes. Now, Simon Shepherd, and he's got a number, 0840-6404. I guess that's his prison number. 0840-6404. CCO/O, Santa Ana Jail, SANTAANA Jail, that's Southern California. P.O. Box 22003. P.O. Box 22003. Again, Santa Ana, California, zip code 92701, 92701, and that's a political prisoner, Simon Shepherd. You can write him there. I would not send anything too inflammatory. They might well seize it from what I know of what Eric Thompson has found, and he corresponds with a number of, he's a white nationalist out in Yakima, Oregon, and he corresponds with a number of whites who are in jail. And he's had his battles with the state of Washington and their discriminatory policy on what he sends people. Okay. And this arrived in the last week from Simon Shepherd. It's not personal. It's a, I want to say press release, but it's not really a press release. It's sort of a notice. Well, I guess it is a press release in that sense. Request dated 5 August 2008, it says. Okay. Um, Someone says, Alex, sound levels are good. Okay, it's been too low. Yeah, I found what that was on the sound levels. I had something, I think the master volume was set a little low, and what I was tweaking up was not what I was tweaking the wrong knob up. So I'm no expert on this. I know enough to do damage. So thanks for letting me know that it's good this time. And I have also, the other good news on the technical front is I believe that Varg and I have solved the problem of this damn pop-up that was interrupting almost every show. So I'm going to hope that doesn't happen today, and I don't think it will. I think we've got it, and that was the one other technical thing. Anyway, back to Simon Shepherd. And you know what? Let me have one more little discursus here. Again, I do the show every Tuesday from 1 until I get tired, basically, or run out of the material I have for that day, but always at least 2 hours. And whatever I say, it doesn't mean anything, because if I get in the mood, I'll just keep going. So it can be up to 4.5 hours. I don't think I would go over, go past 5:30 probably at any point, just because your voice gets tired. But the name of the show is Radio Istina, and Istina is a word I came across in a monograph by a British professor writing about political correctness. And in earlier Radio Istinas, I have gone through that monograph at great length, and we did a close reading of it. We read into the roots of political correctness. And anyway, Istina is the opposite, the counterpart of Pravda, which you newcomers may have heard of. We encourage people to pass this show along. Pravda, if you remember from Russia, means truth, but it means ideological truth or noble truth, and it in real terms, it means a lie. A lie, the equivalent of showing blacks as capable, responsible, upper-middle-class professionals, as TV inevitably does. That's the Pravda. The reality is they're out smoking crack and robbing and raping. That's the Istina in Russia, Istina. So I decided I would call the show Radio Istina. It has a nice little foreign sound to it. And we give you the reality here of what's going on. And so someone encouraged me to say that at the start of every show. Maybe that helps a little bit. But the Istina, in the case of Britain and the U.S., is that the U.S. has thrown Simon Shepherd and Stephen Whittle, or Luke O'Farrell, in jail for pending an asylum hearing, because in Britain it's against the law to expose minorities to any kind of insulting language or stuff that might cause people to react against them, even if what you're doing is merely describing their behavior. And so let's go through this two-page sheet, and then we'll get into the black nationalism with E. Michael Jones and the June issue of Culture Wars. Anyway, so this says, 5 August 2008, request for political asylum, Shepherd, Simon Guy, so I guess it's Simon Guy, G-U-I, or Guy, Shepherd, and Whittle, Stephen. Summary, and I don't know who wrote this. I have to assume that it was written by one of the two of them. Summary, the applicants arrived at LAX, that's the Los Angeles airport, 14 July 2008, so just about a month ago, and made their asylum request to the first official they encountered. The basis of their asylum claim is a 3-year campaign of legal harassment by the governing British Labour Party, culminating in an unprecedented prosecution and subsequent conviction for internet web pages hosted in Torrance, California. Were the applicants to remain or be returned to Britain, they would face substantial prison terms. Now, this is stuff that was supposedly decided, you know, hundreds to a thousand years ago, that you have the right to speak your mind and speak your piece. And that's all they've done. They haven't committed any crimes at all. They have simply written some satire, written some political material, and hosted it on a server in the U.S. And they've been found guilty of that in today's Britain. So those of you who watch Fox News, your friends, aren't going to have any idea that any of this is going on, because it's never reported. So that's why Shepherd sends this to me, because we've had some profitable interchange in the past, and he knows darn well that we're the ones who are going to care about this stuff. And that's why I want you people to take some time to send him a letter. And I will report next week that I sent him a letter, and maybe I'll read a little of what I said. But I have the address for both of these two men, and Simon Shepherd and Stephen Whittle. And I gave you the address earlier. I'll give it one more time right now. This is Simon Shepherd, 08406404, CO Santa Ana Jail, PO Box 22003, Santa Ana, California, 92701. Maybe you could write him a letter this week, and you could tell him that you respect his standing up for free speech and using free speech. And you recognize that, and in my opinion, Shepard's a fine writer. The guy writing is Luke O'Farrell is certainly the most important writer in Britain in 2008. There is absolutely no doubt about it. He is writing the stuff that needs to be read, needs to be understood by people. That's why VNN supports him. People know. They know I don't like Britain. I don't admire British culture, even though I'm descended in good measure from people from the British Isles. And nevertheless, it's our job to stand with anybody when they're right. And these guys are right. They're not only right, they're funny. The stuff O'Farrell writes is far better than the crap you see published on the newsstands or in the bookstores. I mean, this guy's a serious talent, and so is Shepard. Shepard's done more of his writing in the past. Whittle's kind of hitting his prime. I think he's about my age. He's about 41. I'm 42 now. Anyway, going on, that was the sort of the executive summary I read you. The applicants were prosecuted on the basis that a website they contributed to or maintained was, quote, available in England and Wales. So it may be hosted in the U.S., but they're being prosecuted because it is available in England. This heretofore is something we've only seen in conquered Germany, where they are super hard asses about this stuff. They actually have cops who do nothing but patrol online to find people who are making illegal gestures, evincing illegal opinions, or taking photographs of themselves, you know, making bad music even. They bust music over there. Well, now we're seeing that sort of thing spread to England as well, to the United Kingdom or Great Britain. So they're prosecuted on the basis that their website was available in England and Wales. A plea to the jurisdiction challenging the extension of jurisdiction of a British court to internet material hosted in the USA was made in September 2007, but was rejected by the same judge that presided over the trial, that later presided over the trial. So they're like, come on, guy, this website is hosted in the U.S. where the material on it is totally legal. So what basis do you have for jurisdiction? You don't. Judge says, yeah, we do. Up to this point, the applicants had been confident that all of their activities were completely lawful. Okay, we have the First Amendment in the U.S. Under this novel application of the law, and I believe that Germany, conquered Germany, asserts the same thing as this British court is trying to assert, that any material anywhere they don't like is grounds for prosecution. It doesn't have to be on a server in Germany. So, under this novel application of the law, American citizens, or indeed citizens of any nation, are rendered subject to arrest and prosecution by the British authorities for, quote, racially inflammatory material, unquote, deemed, quote, threatening, abusive, or insulting, unquote, placed on a World Wide Web. So, threatening, abusive, or insulting, I mean, as a fact of the matter, any slurs that any MUDs or Jews want to lever against whites is perfectly fine, but whites citing crime statistics or documenting actual colored behavior falls under the category of threatening, abusive, or, you know, subjecting them to insult. So it's a total double standard, and it's a double standard they're trying to assert globally. That's the key here. Just as Israel asserts that they can go anywhere and grab any anti-Semite and try them in Israel, and Germany asserts that they have the right to govern any material that can be seen by, you know, their German web browsers, England's trying to do the same thing. So that if you were ever to go there and you'd publish this kind of material somewhere where it was legal, they could still claim that they can jug you, throw you in jail for it. Back to the sheets. No equivalent legislation exists in American law. Indeed, the applicants are aware of a letter from Californian authorities stating that the material hosted on the heretical website, that's their website, heretical.com, has the highest protection of the U.S. Constitution. That would be the First Amendment. And it's certainly, there's absolutely nothing in there that could get them in legal trouble in the U.S. No evidence was presented at the applicant's trial during June and July 2008, just 1-2 months ago, that any, quote, unquote, racial hatred had resulted from the internet material. The applicant's defense, essentially, was that the material was irony, satire, and parody of political correctness, intended in good humor and for the stimulation of debate. However, the applicable law, the Public Order Act of 1986, removed the requirement to prove intent on the part of defendants, and prosecutions have recently been brought in the absence of a complainant. So this is kind of parallel to affirmative action in the U.S. and Kennedy and the courts fighting to get rid of the need to prove that there was discrimination against blacks, and the mere fact of a statistical disparity was enough to subject the employer to sanctions. Well, here the parallel is that they don't even need anybody to complain. They can make up the complaint themselves and go after you. And we've seen that in the case of the two times they've gone after VNN and me for having a classified ad that contained material they said was illegal. These complaints were not generated by an outside party. They were generated by the Star Chamber Commissions, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And we see exactly the same here in Britain. And the law they're citing, I guess it's falls within the Public Order Act of 1986, removed the requirement to prove intent. So basically they can go around and say, we don't like what you're doing. You're exposing minorities to contempt or insults. Therefore, we're going to throw you in jail. And this ain't their first rodeo, maybe for Whittle, but it's not the first rodeo for Shepard. He's been busted before for passing out flyers. The maximum penalty under this law was increased in a supplement to the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2000 from 2 years to 7 years. They could get 7 years in jail for writing about on-white crime, like Packy's gang raping white girls in Britain, or torturing and murdering them to death. They did with, what was that kid's name, Chris something up in Scotland. I forget his last name. Chris Donald or something like that. I probably got that wrong. But for writing about that, they can get more jail time than the people who committed the crime. This is a common theme in nations dominated by Jews. What they do can't be talked about, or you go to jail. And what they do is loose these muds to destroy the white community, to torture it, to inflict barbarity on it, to terrorize it, and you get more time for talking about that than their criminals do for their acts. Average time served for rape is something like 3 years. Average time served for a convicted murder, something like 7 years. No evidence was presented at the applicant's trial that anyone had accessed the relevant web pages other than the single police officer who had downloaded the website for the purpose of the prosecution. So Officer Friendly is sitting there downloading. He's playing around in the internet and in between going to porn sites, he's downloading political material that Zog/Britain doesn't like, turning it over to prosecutors and having them go after men for using their free speech, which in Britain has been guaranteed for, you know, the better part of 1,000 years, or at least since, what, Runnymede? What was that, 1208 or something, 1216? Magna Carta? The right of the nobles to criticize the king? Calm down there, buddy. You're not actually God on earth. We can make jibes at you, okay? And if you say we can't, we're going to cut off your head. It's that simple. You know, 800, 900 a year. This is stuff Paul Craig Roberts writes about all the time, even though he's a fairy and a three-named wasp, or Scottish, or whatever he is, and criticizes the Nazis who stood up to these tyrants and called them what they were, Jews, rather than just politically correct or liberals. He. This is one of his common themes. His plaints is that, you know, we're undoing 1,000 years of settled law. This, Thomas Jefferson, you know, German forest by way of British Isles. This is the common law as established by people like me and talking and you listening to this. This is what our people found. This way works. You have the right to criticize the powers that be. And that can't be taken away, and that's affirmed in blood. And what the paper says merely secures your natural right to speak freely about that, which is of great concern to you and your kind. You can't be deprived of that. That's what natural law means. They can cut your head off. They can jump on you like they jumped on me. They can throw you in jail like they're throwing Simon Shepherd and Luke Whittle in jail. But the natural law exists. They can pass laws against it, but ultimately, natural law doesn't mean anything because you are the vindicator of it. You have all the freedom you decide to take for yourselves. If they kill you, well, that's a technical matter. They were stronger than you. But no one can take that away without your consent, and you have every natural right to vindicate it through the force of arms. people who pass laws saying that you can't speak your mind, they deserve to be killed. People who pass laws throwing you in jail for writing funny articles deserve to be killed. Numerous defense attempts were blocked during the course of an extremely zealous prosecution. See, this is the thing. Have you ever heard cops all enthusiastic about throwing some nigger rapist or murderer in jail? They almost act like they're sorry they're doing it. But here, when they have political stuff that goes against the regime, my God, they can't wait to get these guys in jail and reject all their defenses and lock them up and throw away the key. That's why it's important you write to these guys who are standing up for freedom. They represent what's best in the West. And it's not the West, it's not the Catholic Church, it's the white blood that's essential here. An earlier appeal court ruling was invoked stating that the truth is no defense. Where have we heard that before? We heard that at the Ernst Zundel trial, where they're trying him for essentially pointing out that the Jews are lying in what they claim about the Holocaust. There weren't any 6 million Jews killed. They emigrated. And the Canadian court said just that. The truth is no defense. Well, here they're saying it in Britain. The truth is no defense. I believe they've even said it in Australia with Friedrich Tobin, German-descended Australian down there, who's famous for rebutting various aspects of the gigantic lie that is the Holocaust. And, you know, the Executive Council of Jews down there, or the British Board of Deputies of British Jews, or the Australia, I forget what they're... They have slightly different names, but they're all the same thing. They're executive boards of Jews who have undue weight through the courts because Jews dominate law school. Maybe we'll talk about that a little. We started a new thread on that. We had an excellent thread that Craig Cobb and I built several years ago, but it was lost in a tragic fire when the This Just In section burned down due to faulty wiring, as they said in Revenge of the Nerds. Well, they said it as a way to escape blame. So we didn't have it backed up properly. We lost that thread. However, I reconstructed the frame of it, and I think an M. Krause is helping us. What we do is go through the top 10 law schools, and then we determine which percentage of the law school professoriate are Jews, and it's usually a third to 50%. Anyway, that's kind of the context here. It's not like that just in the U.S., it's like that in Australia, it's like that in Britain. Same Jews pursuing the same policies. Right? You understand that. Okay, so we have the bald statement, the truth is no defense. An earlier appeal court ruling was invoked stating that the truth is no defense. So if he says something about black crime stats, well, the truth is no defense. You're exposing them to insult. Well, this is a very direct means of suppressing thought. To think is to generalize, is to fit things into patterns and holes, to not only to look at specific items down to whatever grain you need to understand them, but also to stand back and to see where they fit into the bigger picture. And what the Jews are trying to do is use the courts and use the legislature and the media to prevent anyone from seeing what is going on. And what's going on is they are forcibly sticking these animals among us in order to destroy our people while preventing us from talking about it, preventing us from knowing about it, preventing us from seeing the results of their hateful, malicious behavior. That's why I say Jews should be exterminated. They're trying to exterminate us. Gun to a gunfight. An attempt to demonstrate that comparable material to that being prosecuted was readily available in British stores was also blocked. So, Shepherd and Whittle are saying, look, not only is what we're saying true, you can find material that says basically the same thing all over the place. The court's going, so what? We don't care. Truth is no defense. We're going after you. We don't like you. This is very personal. They don't want intelligent, funny white men speaking the truth to Jewish power. Throw them in jail. Oh, the Jews are no, bullshit. The Jews are the persecutors. The white men are the victims. Applicant Shepherd has endured 3 police raids, each of which is believed to have been unlawful and all of which considerably exceeded their proper scope. These took place in 2005, 2006, and 2007. 30 March 2005, 12 April 2006, and they simultaneously raided Whittle also in 2006, and for July 2007. Large quantities of books, scientific papers, computer equipment, financial records, and personal items were removed on each occasion, none of which has ever been returned. It was admitted by the authorities that the third police raid was unlawful. So, the cops have busted. Think about. This is why I want you to write them. They deserve help and praise for what they've done. They're standing up for what's right, and yet they've been raided multiple times and had, you know, their papers and effects, as we say here in the States, in the Fourth Amendment. They've had their papers and effects not only rifled but literally stolen by these political police. Now, you ask the average American, do they think, oh, Britain's a democracy, they have freedom of speech? No, they don't. But this is utterly unknown. This is the meta problem. It's not just a problem. The problem is subsumed by the greater problem. We can't even talk about what the problems are without getting thrown in jail everywhere but the U.S. And even in the U.S., if you don't speak in the free speech zone, i.e. the no-hearing zone, i.e. the baseball field away from the public zone. So they steal his material, nothing's returned, and they even admit that one of their raids was out and out illegal, and of course the others were also. The website, www.heretical.com, consists of 750 pages and over 2 million words, being a collection of articles and excerpts covering a wide range of topics. And if you haven't seen heretical.com, it's still, well, let me check that now. Last time I checked, a week or two ago, it was definitely up. I believe it's still up. Yep, totally up. Got all kinds of great stuff, 100 Luke O'Farrell columns, and all of the categories of Shepherd's work and the excerpts he's collected from brilliant authors and politically incorrect, Semitically incorrect authors, all there. And I recommend you go there and read it and see what these guys are being prosecuted for. He's got 750 pages, 2 million words. 12 web pages were the subject of criminal charges. So they picked 12 pages out of 750, and Shepherd says the main purpose of the website is to act as a vehicle for Shepherd's scientific ideas. And he's developed something he calls procedural analysis, the value of which I don't know. It's interesting to read about it, though. And here we have a little background on these two men. Simon Guy Shepherd. Applicant Shepherd qualifies as an individual with exceptional abilities in the sciences or the arts, i.e. as a potential candidate for the third preference visa category. Now, I don't know what that refers to. Maybe it refers to the U.S. and the categories of visa. So Shepherd's brilliant. He's a potential candidate for the third preference visa category. He holds an honors degree in mathematics from the University of Sussex and has published 2 medical scientific papers as sole author, this latter qualifying him in the older, more stringent system of academic accreditation to 2 doctorates. Subsequently, he developed an original system of behavior analysis called procedural analysis. You can read about this on his site at heretical.com. Which is believed to be a significant advance in human understanding. More lately, he has been self-employed as a web developer, supplier of computer products, and publisher. Applicant Whittle, Stephen Whittle, holds a first-class honors degree in language and linguistic science from the University of York and has written over 20 books on a variety of topics, and he's a fantastic writer. And his satire is as good as anything going right now. It's certainly the best, most important work coming out of Britain. And he's thrown in jail because of it. Yeah, they still throw writers in jail. Just because they don't report it on the Jew-controlled TV doesn't mean it isn't happening. All right, why don't we leave it right there? For now, that's the end of these two papers, and I got that today. I'm going to give you the address one more time. Simon Shepherd, SIMONSHEPPARD. Get it right. I say parenthetically that when they write about the grids positive cruiser Matthew Shepherd, they almost always misspell his Shepherd. This Shepherd's a different spelling. SHEPPARD 0840s 6404. 0840s 6404. CO, Santa Ana Jail. P.O. Box 22003, Santa Ana, California, 92701. We have both his, and I believe they're jugged in the same jail, both Shepherd and Whittle's addresses on VNNforum.com. And go down to our broadcasting section and look up Radio Estina. Yeah, someone says, Stephen Whittle is Luke O'Farrell, whose columns are archived at heretical.com, which is, whose editor, whose publisher is Simon Shepherd, hosted on a site in the U.S. or a server in the U.S. So that's where we are in August. I hope some of you will take the time to write them. I will, and I will speak about it next week, maybe give you a little of what I said. I don't know about you, but I don't write letters nowadays very often. But I'm going to handwrite a letter because it's important. And that's why we spend, 40 minutes talking about this. Now, let's shift gears now. And let's get to the mainstay of what we're going to talk about today. And this is some exciting stuff. What we're going to talk about is Marcus Garvey and black nationalism in the U.S. And E. Michael Jones, who's one of our favorites, even though he is not a Nazi, he is not a racialist, he is a Catholic. He's still an excellent historian and a one-man publishing juggernaut who does his own CDs, he does his own videos, he speaks a lot of places wherever the Jews don't get it canceled. He writes a magazine, culturewars.com, that I would urge you to consider subscribing to. And if you don't, you're going to get a good taste of it today. He's also written 1,000-page tomes of history. We've discussed in earlier Radio Estina's his Libido Dominandi, one of my favorite books, and his new one, which is The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. We've also covered first few chapters of that in the last two Radio Estinas. Today, however, we're going to talk about an article from his June issue of Culture Wars, and he wrote this. It's about 16, 17 pages, Carry the War into Africa, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey. Now, let's set the context here. What you've got is slaves are brought over to the New World. They were brought over primarily by Jews, and the descendants of these slaves became a major political problem in the U.S., as we've discussed with my ancestor, Usher Linder, and Lukey Lawless, and Elijah Lovejoy, and these battles in Illinois preceding the Civil War. Now we're going to move forward a little to the first decades of the 20th century. And you've had Jews come in ever since about 1880. And you've got Jews looking around figuring out, what do we do here? Well, they had a real spur to activity from the Leo Frank case that led to the setting up of the ADL. Frank was a Jewish child molester. He molested a white girl, and the Jews tried. At that point, they didn't have the power they have now, but they still had a lot of power, even though they'd only been in the country for 20, 30 years or even less. They tried to bribe the governor. They tried to get their man free, but no, the citizens of Georgia would have none of it. They wound up bringing justice to Jew Leo Frank and hanging him. And from that spurred the development of the ADL. And the basic idea here is that as a way to protect Jewish rights and privileges, they would use the blacks to mess up the whites, to mess up the white community. Now, how did they do that? Now, this is important. There's three schools, if you think about it. There's these descendants of the slaves, and at this time, there may be 10 million of them in the U.S., I think. Today, there are about 40 million. So you can see that it's a problem that, as they knew in the 1900s, would get worse over, or the 1800s, they knew would get worse over time. How could you deal with this? There were three schools of thought among blacks, whites, and Jews. The one is ship them back to Africa on the part of the whites, or black nationalism, or black Zionism, as advocated by Marcus Garvey, we're going to talk about today. Another school of thought is cast down your bucket, Booker T. Washington, and be satisfied with what you're able to do. Develop your culture. It's understandable the whites are racist. They don't like you. Just develop alongside them separately. Separate but equal. Let's put it that way. Or separate but unequal. It doesn't matter. The key is separate. The third school of thought is let's mix these blacks in with the whites and destroy them, and that will in turn protect our rights as Jews. So, three potential schools, and in the reduced as much as you can analytically, there's mix, separate, or leave. Those are the three options. Mix blacks and whites, leave them separate but on the same continent, or have the blacks go back to Africa. Now, the Jews favored one of those schools, and they used that school and the leaders of it as their front men to destroy the other two schools. So all that mattered was what was good for Jews. What was good for the Jews was destroying Marcus Garvey, because he developed a bit of a following, and the Jews did not want him leading blacks back to Africa, as per the Liberia experiment, as per the American Colonization Society that Lincoln and others belonged to and supported and patronized, who wanted the freed slaves to be sent back to Africa. The Jews didn't want that. They needed them here to mess up white communities. And that in that way, they would protect Jews. So mix, separate, or leave, these are the three school of thoughts. They're identified with the NAACP is for the mixing, the integration. Integration, segregation, or deportation, or just plain leaving, departing. Those are the three different schools. Garvey is the black Zionist, and very much, I use that advisedly, Jones uses it, he's inspired by the idea of Zion. And just at this time, and 20 years before, or 10 years before, in the early 1890s, you've got Theodore Herzl arguing for Zionism and what became Israel in 1948. So the blacks are looking the same way. Hey, if it works for these other people, it can work for us. And they don't really have a problem with whites. They understand the whites are racist, the races are different, the whites don't want to get along. They want to do something good for blacks. The Jews will speak as though they want to do something good for blacks, but what they actually intend is whatever is good for Jews. That's all they ever care about, is what is good for Jews. You'll often see that meme on a sitcom, or Jon Stewart will make a joke about someone's grandmother going, is it good for Jews? And it's supposed to be really funny and cute. Like that, what, Clara Pell's Where's the Beef? But it's really not, because these are the same Jews who will turn around out of the other side of their mouth and denounce you as a hater for advocating what's good for whites. Cute when Jews do it, illegal when whites do it. You get that? I mean, Simon Shepherd is sitting there right now in a jail, surrounded by Mexicans and niggers, because he wrote articles. And in those articles, he advocated defending the white race and its own interests. Defending the British people from the sellouts and the Jews who would import the Third World to destroy their living ways. Visceral stuff, this is vital stuff. I got scolded, I got cuffed, and I remember it from college. One of the few things I remember, unrelated to women, baseball, basketball, or writing political columns, was one of my weakish liberal profs really batting me for using vital casually. So I don't use that casually. It's a vital issue that whites retake control of their countries. And I said this or that. I don't remember the specific. Was it in the vital interest of the U.S.? And he's like, you know what vital means? Vital means life or death. And people wonder why I created a tar corral, why I'm smacking people around. You know what? I've been a nice guy for too long. People are, I'll bring them along, I'll hold their hand, I'll help them get better. You know what? Most people don't want that. The only thing that's going to reform most people is being kicked in the nuts. And the minute I give these people strong criticism, about 50% of them, they curse me, they send me a nasty PN when I ban them, or when I tar corral them, and we don't need that kind of hothead. If you can't handle any kind of criticism, you are useless. If your ego is that weak that the minute someone upbraids you, you fall to pieces, and get lost, man, you're useless. And probably, I don't know what percentage of people are like that, but a heck of a lot. Heck of a lot. So get going. We don't need you. Our vital interests are at stake. We don't need clowns when there's men writing serious columns who are thrown in jail because of it. And you want to be offended because someone asked you to spell correctly. Or separate your thoughts into paragraphs, as is conventional, and not use meretricious trinkets to attract people to what you're saying. Rely on the power of your words. The power of your words, your sentences, your paragraphs. In those lies the attraction, not in some whorish getup where you use, special colored type or big type or all kinds of images and graphics. Should come down to what you say, and if it doesn't, if you don't have any intrinsic charms in your writing, then why are you posting? Don't. Now, with this setup, With this setup, we're prepared to discuss the article, understanding, you know, there's a political problem here. Blacks and whites, do they live together? Do they separate? What do we do? And it's characteristic of madmen, sanctimonious madmen and children, that they have to have their way immediately and nothing but their way and 100% of their way. And if they don't get that, I'm going to scream, as Veruca Salt said in the song. Maybe I'll even play that when I break. But that kind of tantrumic activity to multiply syllables in the way of these pretentious weathermen, that in the way that the middle class loves. Oh, there's tornadic activity. No, there's either tornadoes or there's not. You don't have to add 15 more pair of tornadic activity. Well, there's tantrumic activity where they don't get these niggers liberated in line with what they say is biblical morality, even though the Bible does condone slavery, depending on which part you want to pay attention to. And so the story here is of how Jews used blacks to destroy white society. Now, we won't focus on the destruction today because it wasn't evident. What they were doing back then was laying the groundwork. And what they're doing is using their men and the NAACP, their organization, set up by Jews to destroy competing schools of what is best for blacks. From the Be Humble and Work Hard and Economic Association, advocated by Booker T. Washington, which was the right thing to the extent they are allowed to live among whites, to the Black Nationalist School, Black Zionist School of Go Back to Africa. They destroyed those two, leaving only the third, integration. And we know the cost of integration. We see it in the revised crime file. 40,000 white women raped a year. Well, it's good for Jews. Maybe it's not good for your daughter, sister, mother, aunt, but it's good for Jews. And that's all that matters, right? Until you say otherwise, white man. And that's what you are listening to this. You're a white man. You're not a conservative. You're not a liberal. You're not a Republican. Those things don't mean anything. They're just ways to fool you. Your true interests are racial. Now we'll talk about the article. Let's see, I'll read you some of the good selections from it. And one of the beautiful things about Culture Wars, the magazine, is that A, there aren't any ads in it. B, there are only about 3 articles per issue and a couple of reviews. C, the articles run on for like 20 pages. So it's unique in form. Everything else today follows the TV example of you get maybe, you know, a little smidgen of content and then 3/4 of an hour of stupid, politically correct, semitically correct commercials. Well, no, here you have a guy who's very smart and very learned laying it out for you at length in easy-to-read language, and it's all documented with footnotes, and you can actually come to understand what's going on. I mean, it's great stuff. And that's why I say this is one of only maybe 2 magazines I would even consider paying money for, even though it's not a white nationalist publication. Well, let's just read through some of this. On March 23rd, 1916, a stocky Jamaican, and this guy looks like, I think the name is Bismarcky. Remember that nigger who had that video where he was dressed up as Beethoven playing that stupid song? Well, Marcus Garvey looked somewhat like that. He must have been in the same tribe. So, I don't know, the Mombacks or the Montezas or whatever the hell they're called over there. Yoruba. All right, let's see. Garvey was the... So March 1916... Straight out of Jamaica, a crazy young nigger named Garvey. March 1916, Garvey arrives in New York. Garvey was the precocious son of a hard-headed, litigious Mason who had been inspired by reading Booker T. Washington's autobiography, Up From Slavery. Washington's book set Garvey's brain afire with plans for redeeming the Negro race, which included uniting all the Negro peoples of the world into one great body to establish a country and government absolutely of their own. And at this time, there were like 400 million blacks, whereas today there are probably, in Africa alone, there are probably, I don't know, 650 million or so. The white man's medicine, technology, and solicitousness have multiplied the number of feral, retarded Negroes. Anyway, Where's the black man's government? Where's his king and his kingdom? Garvey asked. When Garvey realized that he could not find them, he came to understand that, quote, there was a world of thought to conquer, and that he could conquer that world by applying the tenets of nationalism then reaching a fever pitch in Europe to the black people of the world and propose Africa as the Negro equivalent of what Theodore Herzl had hoped to set up in Palestine. Remember, Herzl, I believe, convened some Zionist conference in like 1890, 1891, in which they brainstormed and came together to organize for what eventually became Israel. So around this time period, and we're talking, you know, 1916, you know, within 20, 30 years, he's thinking, well, damn, how about a Nig world? We'll set up a Nig world. And all the blacks in America, the descendants of the slaves, the tens of million, the 10 million who are descendants of the few hundred thousand who were brought to the U.S., go back there and form their own country. We don't need the white man. Someone says, and I'm getting a couple of Skype chats here, someone says, hammer the tardiness. More hammering, never enough. I too like ego loons. And this is what we're getting rid of. People who don't have any self-control and who are egomaniacs. If they have an upside at all, we stick them in the tard corral. If they have no upside, we just ban them. Will that mean less post? Yes. Less post, less posters, but it will also raise the average quality of the post. Act adult, act civilized, you won't have any problems at VNNforum.com. Garvey's plan was the black Zionism, and he was the black Moses who was going to set up a Negro state in Africa. Lying on his back at midnight in England during the summer of 1914, Garvey decided, quote, that I should name the organization the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. Such a name I thought would embrace the purpose of all black humanity. On July 20, 1914, Garvey established his organization in Kingston, Jamaica. So 1914 in Jamaica, he sets up this Universal Negro Improvement, UNIA, and African Communities League. By 1915, less than a year later, Garvey concluded he could not bring his plan to fulfillment unless he included America's former slaves in it. Garvey unhesitatingly and unreservedly praised people of color in the United States as, quote, the most progressive and the most foremost unit in the expansive chain of scattered Ethiopia. So these Ethiopian diaspora, we need to regather the sons of Ethiop, the swarthy Ethiopes, we need to regather them in the motherland. Let them have a go with the guerrillas. You need a really fertile cross mixture between, you know, some of the lowland silverbacks and some of the Bismarcky looking Jamaicans. What American Negroes had going for them, Garvey decided, was white racism. What he saw as the, quote, honest prejudices of the white South. And there's more, but think of that. Honest prejudices of the white South. Here's the thing. Blacks and whites can get along to the extent of understanding they are radically different and want to remain separate. Blacks and whites understand that, but when you add the Jew is the one who forces them together in a shotgun marriage. Same Jew who breaks up real marriages with his easy, no-fault divorce laws, flips around when it comes to race, and forces these inherently incompatible creatures together, and proclaims himself moral, more moral than thou, holier than thou, because he's doing what nature itself, left alone, would not do. Without guns, blacks and whites would live separately. What American Negroes had going for them, Garvey decided, was white racism. What he saw as the honest prejudices of the white South. And he's saying what they had going for them. White racism was good for blacks. This is easily demonstrated statistically. Rates of bastardy, income, education, all these things were better and getting better at a faster rate before the communist revolution called civil rights took final power in the mid-60s. So Garvey says what the American Negroes had going for them, Garvey decided, was white racism. what he saw as the honest prejudices of the white South. He's saying there are legitimate reasons for white racism in the South. There are legitimate reasons these people don't want us around or want us segregated from their communities if we have to be on this continent. What he saw as the honest prejudices of the white South, which forced black people to build their own segregated institutions and develop a race consciousness that could in time gain respect from their oppressors. So when you have integration, you let the talented tenth of blacks into the white community, leaving the rest of the blacks headless, essentially retarded animals who are violent and dangerous to themselves and everything around them. But when you have segregation, the talented tenth is kept in the black community, thus keeping a lid on it, keeping a cooler head, and even allowing, you know, blacks had all kinds of businesses then in their own demented and sad, but social ways they were developing. It worked for everybody, segregation did. This was to be a fundamental construct of what became Garveyism, the postulate that racial liberation and empowerment were inherent in racial opposition and alienation. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with Jones's way of characterizing that. I mean, he just said the guy called them the honest prejudices. So I wouldn't say racial opposition and alienation. I would say just separation. Separation. Segregation. Working out their own way without being bossed around by whites, patronized by them. And, you know, even if they're more pathetic intellectually, they can still try to do something. Garvey's plans to meet, again, he's 1916, this Jamaican, 1914, the Jamaican founds the organization. 1916, he comes to New York. He's going to meet with Booker T. Washington, advocate of, you know, black self-help, cast down your bucket. Garvey's plans to meet with Booker T. were thwarted, however, by the death of the Wizard of Tuskegee. That's another name for Booker T. Washington. America now had no universally recognized spokesman for the Negro people. Given his vision in England in 1914, it's difficult to imagine Garvey not entertaining the thought that he was ordained to fill that vacuum. And there's a picture of Garvey he has in his book where you can see what I mean about the resemblance to Bismarcky. And it's Bismarcky if you were dressed not as Beethoven but as Toussaint Louverture, the liberator of Haitian and the slewer of whites. He's got a great what the British Barnett, you know, a hat complete with all kinds of feathers heaped up on top of the hat, and he's got the full bellhop regalia going on below. So this was an early example of a Negro styling. He's also got an award, vaguely military award, slapped on his chest. Not sure what that award would be for, but I doubt it was earned in honest battle. It's more decorative, I think. Negroes are very showy, gaudy people. There's really no such word as meretricious in Negro culture because it's you can't celebrate the tawdrily attractive from the Negro living ways. They're just like that naturally. It's all about externals. Deprived of the ability to meet Booker T. Washington, Garvey decided to meet instead with W.E.B. Du Bois, head of the NAACP. Again, these are the three men who are representative of the three schools. Garvey's the black nationalist, the black Zionist, the back to Africa guy. Booker T. Washington, now dead, is the self-help guy, the cast down your bucket guy. W.E.B. Du Bois is the front of the NAACP, which is set up by Jews. So he's pushing integration. He's the one the Jews are going to use to destroy Garvey, destroy the idea of back to Africa, destroy the idea of self-help, and put the chip on the black man's shoulder, encourage him to blame whites for everything wrong with his community, and thereby retard his progress by making him feel he is not responsible for what happens. Okay, let me interrupt. I've got a communication here from Miles, and he says, "Hello, Alex. I've been doing some research on the Reuben Sturman, the Jew who completely dominated the pornography industry from the 60s through the 90s. As one minor competitor so aptly worded it, Reuben Sturman did not simply control the adult entertainment industry. He was the industry. I know you have discussed how Jews theorize that a sexually immoral culture is much less conducive to anti-Semitism than one with more rigid standards. If you have the time and inclination, would you mind expounding on this a bit today? I do have the... the inclination, but I don't have the time on today's show. But rest assured, and I know Peter Schenck was talking about this on a recent show that I listened to the other day. If you want to get the intellectual backing to this, you got to go to authoritarian personality. And also E. Michael Jones has a lot on this in Libido Dominandi. The Jews believe that, and I'm going into this now just to respond to Miles, but also this ties in with the use of the blacks, because blacks are inherently more animalistic than whites. So anytime you integrate them and you get a twofer, they're not just violent, it's that they just degrade the overall culture. So Jews produce pornography. They produce, in particular, they produce interracial pornography. And they see all of this as undermining not only the white physical plant, white genetic material through interracial stuff, but undermining them morally by a constant cavalcade of homosexuality, interracial themes, reality averse, just anti-reality. It's an anti-world on TV. It doesn't correspond, so it messes you up. The more you look at it, the more confused you get, because it doesn't echo in everyday life, and yet it's more powerful for some reason, relating to human psychology. It's more powerful than what you actually do see. So I'm not going to go into that specific area today, but I will in future shows, and just as I have in past shows. And it's the roots of it are in authoritarian personality. They talk about that. And their belief that there will be less anti-Semitism in a society in which the goyim are taught to be promiscuous and obsessed with sex. Think of a stupid show like Two and a Half Men. You know what? Oh, the one guy's, he's always getting laid, and it's an endless parade of cheerleaders and sex, and there's no room for anti-Semitism because there's no room to be an adult or concern yourself with adult things or exhibit any self-control. And this is how the Jews portray us to ourselves until we become like what they portray, that we're driven purely by money and getting laid. That's what they want us to think that we are. That's how they want us to act. In that way, they will be safe. So that's all I'm going to say about that today. But that motive obviously is tied in heavily with promoting blacks, not just to promote them to break up white society. Well, how do they break up white society? Well, they're violent, they're stupid, and they're promiscuous. Do we need more violent stupidity and promiscuity in America? No, we sure don't. We need less. How are we going to get less when we have people who are literally retarded on average? I mean, Africans are about 70 IQ, and just because they have a white admixture, the blacks in America aren't a hell of a lot smarter. Promiscuous, I mean, there's any number of studies. We have them listed a couple of different places. Blacks have off-the-charts levels of sexual diseases compared to whites. Self-control, blacks have never been noted for self-control. Even blacks who are paid millions of dollars can't control themselves, as you can tell from any look at a crime blotter and see the NFL and NBA players on it. Anyway, back to Garvey. So, Garvey founds his group in 1914 in Jamaica, but then he realizes, oh, I got to have the American niggers on my side or this isn't going anywhere. Comes to New York in 1916, wants to visit Booker Washington. Booker Washington's dead, so tries to go see Dubois. Dubois was out of the office when Garvey arrived, and Garvey, hoping for another meeting, left his card. Years later, Garvey would claim that when he left Dubois' office, he was, quote, unable to tell whether he was in a white office or that of the NAACP. Here's the thing. Jews set up the NAACP, and they employed, like, octoroons and quadroons, that is, blacks with a lot of white blood, in order to put the charade over better. So it's, again, it's a front operated by Jews, just the way Jews are trying to set up white fronts today. You understand. That's why I coined WINO, white in name only. People who ostensibly advocate white interests, but are really advocating Jewish interests. Their function is to protect the Jews in case there's ever a white uprising against Zog, or the destruction that Zog engenders with its insane policies. Provides whites with an opportunity to re-seize control in places. The Jews want to be sure that they are seen as whites, even though everywhere else they're not white. So Jews are manipulative. All they do is set up false fronts. All they do is accuse other people. They never admit any blame for anything themselves. Now, yeah, Miles, I will talk more about that later. And the reason another reason I don't go into today is I don't have the information right at hand, but I know it's cited in McDonald. It may be cited in Slezkind. I haven't read that. We wrote about Jewish power in the 20th century. It's authoritarian personality is boring, but it's there. It's also in E. Michael Jones, and I recommend you get his books and read through this. And we still haven't gotten to that portion of Libido Dominandi where that's discussed. Anyway, so Garvey visits Dubois. He doesn't see him, and he says years later, you know, he's left with the impression of the office of Jesus. It's a white office more than a black office, even though it's NAACP and is supposed to represent blacks. So it's a competitive organization, a competitive approach to what's good for blacks. You know, I'm making this as simple and repetitive as I can because I want it to stick with you so that you can intelligently discuss the history of Africans in the United States and how they were used by Jews over the course of the 20th century to empower the Jews and to destroy the whites. And you have a good, thoroughgoing understanding of this. And we get our knowledge of this from solid historians like E. Michael Jones, who's a Catholic and not a white nationalist, yet the information he provides is valid as long as it's documented and we can use it for our purposes. You should be able to understand this by the time we're done today and discuss it with your neighbors and friends. You should always be able to see whatever happens to your community, and we'll talk about what's going on here in Kirksville, and place it in proper context. Why is that Mexican drug dealer here? Why is this white broad shacking up with this crazy Mexican? Who opened the borders? You know, just as you should know who opened the borders to explain Mexico, you should know who opened your community to niggers when they used to be shut out of the white community. And what you learn is, well, when you inspect it, well, it was the Jews. The Jews set up the NAACP. The Jews hobbled. The Jews cut off at the kneecaps black nationalists and black self-help. And they urged blaming whites and integration and the government doing everything for you. That's the school it dominated. When relations between the two men, that would be Garvey and Dubois, deteriorated, Garvey would later criticize Dubois as, quote, a white man's nigger. The claim was partly true. He says partially true. I would say partly. People use partially where I guess it's technically correct, but it's like so many of these disputes. And here's another thing I want to interject here. I've created a language forum on VNN. And I put in there people who spell stuff wrong, I correct it, and bad grammar. And people who compile dictionaries tend to be liberal in the sense that misuses much more quickly than they should, per there is no law save usage, become official and respectable. So it may be that way with partially versus partly. People use partially where they could or should use partly. Even PhDs like Jones. Now, I don't know that he's wrong because I think they probably do accept that now, but really it should be partly, not partially. Partial means you're biased. It partly means a section of. When relations between the two men deteriorated, and for those of you who are new listeners, this is what I do. As soon as I find something, I go off on that tangent like a dog chasing a butterfly across a park. And that's one of the prerogatives of doing my own show. But you know what? It all reinforces and coheres in the end because I've thought it through years ago and everything reinforces the rest to give you a picture, the most accurate picture of any radio host, I sincerely hope, of what is actually going on in the world and what needs to be done about it. I don't think you'll disagree with me about what needs to be done about it when you understand it. And it's good to be back in the saddle and having done the show for 3 or 4 weeks in a row now and having blessed by the great people who created drugs to have, I'm hoping and crossing my fingers, some degree of control over this medical condition I've had. And the first drugs that I had to take for it were just off the charts expensive. And, you know, I went back to the doctor. I'm like, you know what, I can die for free. I don't need to be taking this crap that costs that much money. And luckily, I've now got one that it doesn't have the buffers, so I guess presumably you might have more side effects, but it's cheaper. It's like 1/10 of the price of the other one that's under patent and has a has a trade name. This one is and I found online too, which is an interesting thing. I'll probably broach on the forum at some point, because this is all new to me. I don't know if you're like me, but I try to avoid all drugs. I'm not talking about illegal. I'm talking about legal drugs. I try to take as few medications as possible. And I want to feel everything that's going on. And that's the right way to live. Stay out of doctor's offices. Stay away from pills. Don't drink lots of crap. Drink water and try to get water without fluoride. Try to eat food rather than processed junk. You'll be better off. Anyway, my discursus on partly. Anyway, he says, the claim was partially based on the fact that Dubois was a mulatto, but it was also based on the fact that many of the NAACP's Negroes were quadroons and octoroons, and these are words referring to blacks of partial white heritage or part white heritage. So whether they're one, their specific words for mulatto means half, quadroon means a quarter, octoroon means an eighth, and there are even, I forget the other words, but there's all kinds of different words. I know in Brazil they have like 32 different Spanish words for different types of mixes. Anyway, so Garvey kind of, you know, he has a falling out with Dubois years later as they're obviously pushing different agendas, and he says, I didn't know whether I was in a black office or a white office. And E. Michael Jones says the NAACP's Negroes were quadroons and octoroons. Many of the NAACP's Negroes were quadroons and octoroons. Men like Walter White, who looked so white that the NAACP used them as spies in the South. And also this would help sell black rights, just as they do now, using someone like Holly Berry. Oh, isn't she beautiful? Well, she's the rare black who's half white who actually has a white body shape. And it helps sell their idea that black, that it's just about skin color, that it's just skin deep, when in fact it goes all the way through the marrow. So they use unrepresentative specimens to put across the big lie of racial equality and the absence of racial differences. Well, they were doing that 100 years ago here in the NAACP, as he says. By the way, if any of you disagree with me that stupider is better than more stupid and stupidest is preferable to most stupid and that those other ones don't even exist, I'm going to track you down. I feel extremely strongly about that. It's stupid, stupider, stupidest. And ultimately, sound rules those things. And that's my turf. I know that as well as anyone in the world. And it's stupid, stupider, and stupidest. Not more stupid and most stupid. It really agitates me. Irritates me. Annoys me. Anyway, so 100 years ago, Jews are using blacks. They're using white-skinned blacks to put across their anti-white agenda. Garvey was ever the race man, says Jones, but his racism blinded him to the fact that white in this instance meant Jewish. The NAACP was a creation of wealthy New York Jews whose desire to do something about lynching in the South took on a new urgency in light of the death of Leo Frank. We'll go into this in other shows because there's a couple preceding issues. He has a long two-part history of the Leo Frank deal that created the ADL. And this is how Jews are. Even when their own member is raping and murdering white girls, they still don't want to see him brought to justice. So these are not people who can live among us. They have a fundamentally different view of us than we have of them. We look at them as fellow creatures and individuals and people of a different religion. They look at us as animals. Animals at their disposal, even unto the rape and murder of. It's not a crime in Jewish so-called religion to rape and murder goyim. Goyim exist only to serve Jews. Here we have a Catholic historian pointing out that the NAACP was created by Jews. Jones is not a Nazi. He's not a white nationalist. Yet he's saying exactly the same thing we are, because it's the facts. NAACP was created by Jews to serve Jewish interest, not to serve black interest, and certainly not to serve white interests. Someone tells me stupider sounds super retarded. Again, you don't know the facts. Look the goddamn thing up. The word, it's the comparative of stupid is stupider. And it doesn't sound stupider, it sounds better than more stupid. More stupid sounds stupider than stupider. Look it up. There's no such thing as more stupid. That sounds positively retarded. Now I'm getting incensed. Even as I look at this hilarious picture of Marcus Garvey, and you've probably seen this. I think it may even be in the standard Jew histories used in history texts used in public schools. I know I've seen this picture before, but the plume, the it's not just one feather. It's not a plumed cap. It's got a whole goddamn bird up there. Equatorial guinea fowl or something is roosting on top of this Bismarcky's head. Anyway. The NAACP was a creation of wealthy New York Jews whose desire to do something about lynching in the South took on a new urgency in the light of the death of Leo Frank, a Jew who molested, raped, and murdered Mary Fagan, a worker in his pencil factory down south. Just as they always do in that case, you know, the Jews screamed, oh, it's anti-Semitism. They rape and murder the daughters of the White South, and it's anti-Semitism if you demand that the rapist and murderer be hanged. The Jews also tried to blame it on a nigger. So the Jews have no love for blacks. Jews have love for Jews. Everybody else they hate. Common enemy of all mankind, as the Romans said a couple thousand years ago. In 1915, Louis Marshall, head of the American Jewish Committee and author of the failed motion to win him a new trial, joined the board of the NAACP. 7 years after Frank's death, Marshall was still smarting from the insult he had to bear when the Supreme Court rejected his plea for a new trial. So the head of the AJC, that along with the ADL is very powerful, head of the AJC, trying to get Louis Frank a new trial, he's rejected by the Supreme Court. And now he joins the board of the NAACP. There has been perhaps no crime committed in our day that can compare in lawlessness with the lynching of Leo Frank, whom I represented before the Supreme Court of the United States, Marshall wrote in 1922, at the time of the Dyer anti-lynching bill. Marshall was appalled by the lynching of Leo Frank, saying that it moved him, quote, to form the resolution to do whatever it lay in my power to do to assist in putting an end to so monstrous an iniquity as lynching. The NAACP was against lynching, so it seemed only natural that he would join the board of that organization. But that decision was to have fateful consequences for both the nation's Jews and the nation's blacks, as well as the nation as a whole. Instead of using the AJC to fight lynching, Marshall chose the NAACP as his vehicle, and in doing so became involved in using the nation's Negroes as proxies in the Jews' war against anti-Semitism. Again, Jews using Negroes as proxies in their war against anti-Semitism. And by anti-Semitism, they mean whites getting incensed when Jews rape and murder white daughters. You know, if that's anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism is a damn good thing. Marshall, in other words, says E. Michael Jones, joined the board of the NAACP to get revenge on the South by turning the Negro into the nation's revolutionary avant-garde. So in response to Leo Frank being brought to justice, the Kikes set up the NAACP and are going to use the black man to stick a spear through the heart of the white South. Harold Cruz, perhaps because he was a communist, and as a result more aware of how that group of Jews tried to use the nation's Negroes as their avant-garde, eschews revolutionary terminology in describing the NAACP's philosophy, but the accusation of duplicity is there nonetheless. So the Jews are doing one thing and proclaiming another. Oh, we want to help the blacks. Oh, the Black Jewish Alliance. Well, it's a Jewish-Jewish alliance to promote what's good for Jews at the expense of blacks and the expense of whites. Even under the wrecking of the white nation. Good for Jews. That's all that matters. Good for Jews. Louis Marshall, according to Cruz, who I take it as a Jew and a communist writer, revolutionary, was inspired. Louis Marshall, the Jew, was inspired to complement the program of the NAACP by virtue of the legal axe he had to grind with the Supreme Court over constitutional principles when the court turned down his appeal arguments in favor of Leo Frank. the Jew who raped and murdered Mary Fagan. Black civil rights and the NAACP represented the legal instrumentalities by which Marshall could salve the bitter gall of defeat he had experienced in the Leo Frank case, Frank v. Mangum. So, you reject my appeal, oi! All that means we have not taken over the court yet. We will go at it another way. We will set up the NAACP. We'll use the black to destroy you. You're anti-Semitic if you object. The policy of gunpoint and forced integration. I don't care how many white women get raped. I don't care. It's not my concern. Good for Jews. It's good for Jews. We must never have another Jewish pedophile lifted off his feet by a rope thrown over a tree. That must never happen again. Never. Cruz claims that Marshall, as head of the AJC, would never have accepted the constraints Jews placed over black aspirations at the NAACP. So they set it up. Yeah, we got a black organization, but goddamn it, nigger, you're going to do what we tell you to do. You're not going to do what's good for you or what you think is good for you. You're going to do what we tell you to do. But Marshall's role at the NAACP only compounded the conflict of interest that began to grate on Negro nerves. At no time or place, on no issue or circumstance in the duration of this alliance, were Jews of any parochial persuasion ever called upon to sacrifice Jewish interests on behalf of civil rights. But the Negroes in this alliance had to forego any form of economic ethnic solidarity, the very thing that made Jews powerful, says Jones, if they wanted to continue Jewish support. So the Jews are banding together economically and making money by self-dealing and self-serving, and using that money to set up these lobbying groups to protect their interest. And they're also, as part of that cost, setting up groups ostensibly representing blacks, but in fact pursuing always and only the Jewish agenda. And as Jones says, never sacrificing, or he quotes, never sacrificing their own interest one inch, but forcing blacks to sacrifice their own interest while operating under the black name. Says Jones, it was precisely economic ethnic solidarity which Marcus Garvey began proposing to Harlem shortly after his arrival there in 1916. And it was precisely W.E.B. Du Bois, acting as the agent of the NAACP, the Jew-controlled front group, which opposed Garvey's vision of black Zionism once he began to attract significant crowds. So just as Chester Doles was thrown in jail on a legal technicality after he began to attract dozens upon dozens of activists interested in solving the immigration and other problems, just as he was thrown in jail when he began to attract lots of people, the Jews began to go after Marcus Garvey because he was proposing a model that would help blacks but wouldn't help Jews. And that was their goal in setting up the NAACP as a front and using W.E.B. Du Bois as a front, was to advance their own interests. Black interests be damned. What's good for the black is to develop on his own, keeping his talented tenth in his own community, develop his own economic empowerment through small businesses, and not to blame the white man for protecting the white man's interest through laws built on recognition of racial differences, i.e. their racial capacity for violence, for stupidity. Keep them away from us. The white man was just doing what was natural, normal, and necessary to protect his own. And the talented tenth of the black people could understand that. They might have felt a little slighted and being looked down upon, but they had to agree. The fact of the matter is blacks are simply not as intelligent or as organized as whites. They're not capable of building civilization, but left to their own devices, they are capable of destroying civilization. And they weren't even left to their own devices. Under white rule, they were segregated, but under Jew rule, they were forced among whites precisely with that end in mind, to destroy the white community. You understand? I know I'm being repetitive. I know I'm saying the same thing 35 times. But damn it, you got to understand this stuff. It's hugely important. Your kid is not going to be taught this at school. He's going to be deracinated, cut off from the roots. You need to have the roots connected to the flower and the stem and the rest of it and understand the whole thing. Understand where you are. What you mean. What does your life mean? To understand that, you have to understand the history of your country and your people. That's what Jones is laying out that we're so lucky to have. He spends the time doing this. So Garvey in Harlem in 1916 is advocating black economic ethnic solidarity. Do business with other blacks. Help other blacks. And W.E.B. Du Bois, as the agent of the NAACP, the Jewish-controlled civil rights group, so-called, opposes Garvey. How can you oppose economic ethnic solidarity for blacks and claim to represent black interests? Doesn't make any sense. Murray Friedman claims that black and Jewish interests were identical during the 20s and 30s, but the behavior of the NAACP belies this. The first manifestation of the so-called Black-Jewish Alliance was Du Bois' attempt to destroy Booker T. Washington. This is the now-dead Negro who told blacks to cast down their bucket where they were. Don't agitate for special rights and privileges and whatever. Just concentrate on working and getting married and saving money, and in that way you will get ahead and earn the respect of the white man in a way you'll never get from pure agitation alone. So Du Bois and the NAACP, controlled by Jews, attempted to destroy Booker T. Washington and his reasonable advice, and then they turned around and tried to destroy Marcus Garvey and his Back to Africa black nationalist movement that was simultaneously advocating economic empowerment of the type, I guess, urged by Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. was saying, what's good for blacks, good for everybody. Develop your skills, develop your learning, have the right values, have a big family, stay together. All these good things work for anyone who practices them, even if blacks can't practice them on the same level. You understand? They can at least do a little. They can be better off. Just because something's bad doesn't mean it can't be worse. Right? Just because something can't be perfect doesn't mean it can't be made a little bit better. In that window of possibilities given to us by God or granted by genetics from evolution, there are a range of possible outcomes, and our decisions determine which outcome we get. The Jews, so far from being the blacks' friend, are urging them in the very worst direction. Blame the white man for all your problems. Look to him for all your solutions. And any responsible black, just as today we find, like Elizabeth Wright, for example, any responsible black who sees what's going on and urges what is truly in the interests of blacks is denounced and undercut by the Jews. Only those who the Jews say are allowed to represent the black community. And that means Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. That's why they are front and center for blacks. Or a Marxist mulatto, race hustler like Obama is front and center, rather than blacks who speak about what the black community owes whites. You only ever hear in Jew media about what the whites owe the blacks. You never hear about what the blacks owe the whites. You hear about reparations. When are the blacks going to reparate whites for all the murder and mayhem they spread over the last 40 years when the Jews loosed them on us? Never hear that kind of talk. So the first manifestation was NAACP's attempting to destroy Booker T. Washington and his cast down your bucket self-help philosophy. The second manifestation was Du Bois' attempt to destroy Marcus Garvey, the black Zionist, the back to Africa blackie. The conclusion scheme's inescapable, says Jones. Du Bois' job was to promote integration and destroy any black leadership in competition with the NAACP, which was a Jewish front. According to Cruz, that meant an attack on anyone who proposed economics as the foundation of black ethnic solidarity. Cruz sees irony in the fact that this was precisely the basis of the ethnic solidarity which Marshall, Lewis Marshall the Jew, as the head of the American Jewish Committee, AJC, was proposing for Jews. So, one thing is good for Jews and another thing is good for blacks. For themselves, ethnic solidarity, working together, raising money, keeping it in the community. For blacks, no, that's bad. No. Ethnic solidarity, cast down your bucket, self-help, responsibility, those are bad for blacks. They're good for Jews, but they're bad for blacks. Yet again, everything that's good, the Jews want to keep from blacks or whites. For us, they want what's bad, what's destructive, what destroys our communities, what wrecks our nation. Jews are evil. I don't know how Jones just doesn't come out and say that in four or five words. Jews are evil. Three words. Jesus wept, and Jews are evil. They're evil. Any situation, I've said, as a mind experiment, a thought experiment, take any situation. What do you have to do to make it worse, to mess things up, to destroy lives, to wreck nations and communities? What do you have to do? Sit down, figure it out. The minute you come up with something, that will have proven to bend the Jewish agenda historically. Claim blacks are equal to whites, even though there's no evidence. Claim race doesn't exist. Mix the races at gunpoint. Throw anyone in jail who writes about what's actually going on. Boy, we see it all in today's show, don't we? We see how it all fits together. So the evil Jews use the NAACP to destroy competing schools for the blacks, for the black minds. Three options for blacks. Go back to Africa. Live separately and develop on your own as best you can. Or blame whitey and demand rights and reparations. Number three is good for Jews. That's what we pushed. That's what happened. They won. Now we see the result. And that's why I say there's no way out but through the Jews. No way out but through the Jews. They are responsible for wrecking our nation. Every symptom of decline we all notice and can't stand. All trace back to the Jews. All trace back to organized Jews doing what's good for Jews, knowing that it's bad for whites and intending it to be bad for whites. Just as they intended this to be bad for blacks. And so they undercut Garvey. They undercut Washington, offering blacks the correct solution. Recognize a man's got to know his limitation. Well, so does a gorilla. A gorilla's got to know his limitations. If all you can do, friend, is gather banana leaves and make a knight's nest, you know what? You still got to do that. It's important. You don't blame humans because you're a gorilla. They didn't make you that way. They just protected their own kind from the consequences, and that's not hate. Everywhere we encounter the Jew, every point at which the Jew touches white society, superating lesions result. Everywhere. Jews are evil. So it's one thing, one standard for Jews, another standard for everybody else. We see that applies to blacks just as much as to whites. And you know what? I can tell we're not even going to get through this all today, but we're going to keep going. As long as I've got breath, I'm going to bring you the truth about the Jewish people. Can you imagine that? Defending a pedophile. And then when you lose and the pedophile gets justice, gets rope tree justice, well, I'm going to get back at you. I'm going to found the NAACP and I'm going to use these blacks to destroy you. You don't like Jews raping and murdering your daughter? How you like a bunch of niggas doing it? Maybe it's better you just put up with occasional Jew molesting your daughters and raping you. You don't want to put up with any. How about a million niggas attacking you? See if you like that any better, you schmuck. You filthy shaggotses crawling around in the North Georgia woods. You see the move out of you deliverance motherfuckers? This is how Jews are. They're vicious, hateful, spiteful, vengeance-seeking, parasitic monsters. The Jews are the only people who own the media, who control the media, or need to twist what Mark Twain said about man being embarrassed. Jews have to control the media because otherwise the media will be used to point out what they're up to. Once they control the media, why? Criticizing them becomes a crime. Did Simon Shepherd rape someone and murder him? No. He hosted a web page. It contained material they didn't like, so they threw him in jail. Did Luke O'Farrell murder somebody? Did he molest and then rape and then murder a Jewish girl, and that's why he's in jail? No. He wrote a column. He wrote a political column. Had to throw him in jail. The Jews didn't want to do it. They felt they owed it to him. Absolutely absurd. We get what we tolerate, and until we start killing these Jews, they're going to keep on doing this. Their MO is clear. They've been doing this for 2,000 years. And the Catholic Church doesn't have the answer to them. Even the Nazis didn't have the answer. The answer is not discriminating against Jews. It's exterminating them. That's what their behavior shows they deserve. And that is what we must do to protect ourselves. We require no defense. We require no advocacy. We are what we are, and there's absolutely no reason to be ashamed or embarrassed about it. We didn't sic blacks on Jews. They sic blacks on us. And there's more. And these people just endlessly, the false front, the false flag, these are by way of deception, the Jew makes his way in the whites' West. By way of deception. They're always deceiving you. They're always putting things forward under someone else's name. That's why I get angry. I see white people do that on my forum. No, I kick them off. Put forward stupid ideas under your own damn name, not my name. Someone says I sound a little Guido. I got a little Guido mixed in with the Shylock. Well, you know, I can only do certain types of voices. I can't imitate everything like a Rich Little, but there's certain ones I can do. I can do Indian, do Irish a little bit. I can do Jewish a little bit. I can do the Guido a little bit. But yeah, I haven't perfected it. So sooby. I do what amuses me. And I trust it will amuse and instruct others. I didn't hear people talking like this when I was in college. I never had anyone give me a lecture about black history. And oh, here's what was actually going on. Yeah, parents paid a shitload of money for me to get that education, but I didn't actually know that much, did I? No, I didn't know any of this stuff. No one ever told me, like, oh, yeah, Jews are using blacks to destroy the country. And they're also instigating all these foreign... I took a lot of foreign policy. I was an international relations major. I had a lot of foreign policy. No one ever told me, like, yeah, the Jews are basically using the white countries to... for their own ends. They instigated these wars. They guaranteed they'd get America in if we gave them Palestine. Yeah, no one ever mentioned that. This stuff is not taught in liberal arts curricula. You have to find it on your own, and thank God for the internet. Now, where were we? Okay. So Marshall's saying one thing for Jews, economic empowerment for us, but not for blacks. For them, we need them to whine and complain and demand rights and privileges and welfare. Okay. Yeah, in 1 hour we've made it like 2 pages into this article that's like 30 pages long. Oy en vey. All right. And he's got, in Culture Wars, the only illustrations are really like photos of the people at the time. So he not only has Marcus Garvey, he's got Craig's going to hate me for this, but he's got one of Franz Boas, a big portrait, black and white. And he looks He looks a little bit like Craig Cobb. That's all I'm saying. Just a little bit. Looks a little bit Cobbish. He's got that kind of that wild man look in his eye, and lots of hair around his mouth. That's Franz Boas. And let's see here. Anyway, you know who Boas is, but Jones goes into him. This is just beautiful history. Anyway, according to Friedman, so this is the Jew writer Murray Friedman, who I'm not familiar with, but presumably some historian. According to Friedman, Jews and Negroes were united in the scientific attack on racism. So here's another thing at the same time. At the same time that Jews are immigrating to this country from 1880 to 1920, remember, you got something in the context here. 1924, you got the Immigration Restriction Act that Jews hated, and it was kind of like the last major act where their agenda didn't prevail. And they were calling us all Nordicist and evil racist and nativist and whatever. All their spitting language was dragged out, but there was still enough white control to prevent them from getting their way. It would take them another 40 years of agitation to get the 1965 Act. And at the same time, of course, all this civil rights stuff, too. Completing the communist takeover, I would say. But back at this time, as Jews were still coming into the country and getting established and making their money, and getting into the schools, they hadn't created all this stuff, but what they were doing was slowly infiltrating academia and buying up media. And the academic infiltration was carried out through people like Franz Boas, who more than anyone else spread the idea that race did not exist. before the Jews showed up, we had what was called physical anthropology. That was like, you know, go out and dig up bones and then and tools and put them together and try to figure out what was going on. After the Jews showed up, Jew Franz Boas, coming over from Germany, where he's a Marxist socialist over there, comes over here, claims race doesn't exist. That doctrine is then spread through all the media that the Jews are buying. So they're deliberately lying about race. Oh, race doesn't exist. At the same time, they're pushing through their false fronts, NAACP, the integration of race. Well, if race doesn't exist, then obviously there shouldn't be laws or social restrictions against blacks anywhere or Jews. You see, and at this time, not only did we believe in racial differences, we believed that Jews were basically filthy, scummy parasites, and they were banned from the better hotels. So the Jews are trying to get rid of all this stuff at the same time, and they do this by promulgating doctrines they know to be false. By promulgating doctrines they know to be false. They know race exists. They just claim it doesn't. They just play on TV that it doesn't exist. Boas knows damn well that race exists. They just pretend that it doesn't. And they train up these idiotic dolts beneath them to go out and see, just like cancer cells will spread through the body across America. And at these teachers' colleges, or they'll set up sociology departments, they'll set up anthropology departments, and they'll promulgate these false doctrines to your and my sons and daughters who are going to school in these cow states. Well, I learned something, you know. I used to be a hick. Of course I thought race existed. We didn't want any niggers in our town. Then I went off and I got me a college education. And now I know that all those hicks back there, they just don't know what's going on. Race doesn't exist. And this is the way. These white goobers come into these schools and they are taught these false doctrines and they don't know any better than to gulp them. Part of the mission of this show is to educate you in the truth, to teach you to be sophisticated. You wouldn't put just anything into your body. Well, don't put just anything into your head. Before you put something into your head, well, it sounds good, I'll believe it, sure. Look at it the reverse way. Turn it over in your mind. What would the guy on the other side of this say? Think that race doesn't exist? What is your evidence? What does your senses tell you? Does your senses tell you that race doesn't exist? Does your reading tell you that race doesn't exist? Does that seem right? Does it look right? What would the other guy? The other guy would say, well, race does exist, and there are 1,000 physical differences and behavioral differences, and the wisest men of our own race say that it does exist, and they built their policies around its existing, so why should I abandon all that in light of this scurvy little radical-looking, incentive-to-lie Jew? Why should I believe what this Jew is selling? And that's what I said one time when David Halberstam was alive. That kite came through Kirksville, and I went to his meeting, and I stood up and I said, why should the good white people of Kirksville accept what some liberal Jew like you says as opposed to the wisdom of our white founders? And that kite turned redder than 3 beets, 2 strawberries, and a giant tomato. I mean, his big Jewish head turned completely red. And I wanted to go down there and smite him, I'll tell you. I literally wanted to go down and cut his goddamn head off because I know what he's doing. And I want you to be as angry as I am when you understand what the Jews have done to your nation. They're feeding your kids lies and you're paying for it at these colleges. You won't learn any of this stuff at the college you go to. You'll be taught that America's all about, oh, progressive unfolding and the promise of liberating all these different groups and giving them equal rights. No, that had nothing to do with America. Let's get back on the subject here. So, Jews are spreading these intellectual lies. At the same time, they're creating the political organizations and the so it proceeds in tandem. They're proceeding along these different tracks. Buy up media and spread the lies of these new schools of anthropology that are blossoming around the nation and create the political organization. And they all push the same doctrine. They're all pushing race doesn't exist, therefore we must amalgamate the races, and that's the only good Christian moral thing to do. So this is what's going on in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. This is the beginning of a white nation being messed up. Well, it's not entirely the beginning. You got the Civil War and the rest, but still people had a good understanding that the races were not the same and were not equal by any means. According to Friedman, Jews and Negroes were united in the scientific attack on racism. But as evidence for this alliance, Friedman again cites Dubois, the NAACP, and the School of Anthropology, which is the German Jew Franz Boas, B-O-A-S, Franz Boas, founded at Columbia University. Dubois got hired as the editor of the NAACP magazine because his book, The Philadelphia Negro, published in 1899, linked him to Boas' School of Environment-Based Sociology. That is, the Negro is a function of a lack of money or of growing up in the wrong circumstances, and if you change those, the Negro will alchemize into a human. Just as the Jones School claims that a Negro is just, or a Jew is just an unconverted Catholic, the sociological school, the anthropological school that says race doesn't exist is saying, no, race doesn't exist. It's just bad circumstances, bad social institutions. You change those in the tax laws, and bang, that Negro becomes a human. Not true. And I've satirized that by saying ultimately they're saying that black skin itself is a product of how you're raised. So if you put money in a Negro's pocket, if you keep pouring the nickels in, eventually the Negro turns white because he has enough money. Once he has enough money, he stops being black. How insane is that? It's like saying if you pay a cat enough money, it will become a dog or become a human. You know, if you pay the pig enough money, you've changed its circumstances enough, you know, it will start, you know, being a vegetarian and singing opera. I mean, it's just insane. The creature is what the creature is. Money is not going to change its fundamental nature. Yet that's what all these claims are. Oh, we got to have more money, more money. The Negro grew up in poverty. That's why he doesn't like to read books or clean up his yard. No, not true. Obviously not true. And yet it fools millions of people. So Dubois is hired by the Jews who set up the front group, the false front NAACP, to advance Jewish interests. They say, they look around the country. They say, who are we going to hire as a black face to put on our Jewish organization? They say, well, how about let's hire Dubois, W.E.B. Dubois. In his book, The Philadelphia Negro, he's promoting our brother, Franz Boas, a Jew socialist from Germany. He's promoting Jew Boas's bogus theories of race and poverty and all this. So that's what they do. And we'll use this Negro who's already promoting our policies to wreck competing schools of black thought. The Cast Down Your Bucket self-help school of Booker Washington and the Back to Africa school of Marcus Garvey. The scientific attack against racism, according to Friedman, proved enormously significant within the academy at a time when it was still widely accepted by white Americans that blacks were genetically inferior and therefore undeserving of full citizenship rights. Understand that? So at this point, you've got Jews, just like a cancer cell, you've got a healthy white body, healthy attitudes on race, and the Jews come to this country from Russia and Poland, they start spreading these lies, promulgating these false doctrines. And once these are wide enough spread and they've taken over the law schools, which we've also got a new threat on, and they own the major media, well, all of a sudden their agenda, their views become law. And we suffer the consequences of this. They're putting our nation to the sword of their lying policies that are only good for them. They're not good for whites. They're not even good for blacks. They're only good for Jews. Friedman claims that Dubois' book broke new ground in its emphasis on environmental rather than genetic factors as the primary cause of black poverty and crime. You see, if it's genetics, it can't be changed. But if it's environmental, then it can be changed. And they would use this lie, this big lie, to extract money from the white population to do nothing more than objectively grow giant colonies of substandard Negroes. Substandard by white standard. Grow giant colonies of Negroes that despoil the white community using the white man's money. How insane are we to tolerate these Jews doing this? Utterly insane to tolerate Jews. A Jew anywhere is a threat to whites everywhere. According to Murray Friedman, the two U.S. leaders of the environmental sociological movement early in the century were Du Bois, the black intellectual, and Franz Boas, a German-Jewish anthropologist. Du Bois attributed his own early interest in Africa to a lecture delivered by Boas at Atlanta University. So, what you have is these Marxist Jews in Germany, Russia, Poland, they come over here the turn of the century, 1900. They start promulgating their false doctrines, and a young Negro intellectual hears this false doctrine and writes a book based on it and becomes head of the Jewish organization used to destroy whites. You see how it fits together. The Boasian school would produce some of the most famous names in American sociology during the course of the 20th century, including Edward Sapir, S-A-P-I-R, Melville Herskovitz, Ruth Benedict, and Margaret Mead, whose fantasy about adolescent free love in the South Pacific, coming of age in Samoa, was done under Boas's direction. And again, Miles said earlier he wanted me to talk about promiscuity. Well, here's a good example of it. You have a Jew come over, Franz Boas, he comes over from Germany, he's a socialist, he starts spreading this doctrine that race does not exist in order to fight anti-Semitism, because if race doesn't exist, then, oh, once the Jews have a little bit of money, they'll quit acting like Jews. And once the blacks have a little bit of money, they'll quit acting like blacks, so we need to get rid of these laws. So this Jew, Franz Boas, comes over and teaches this to American sapsuckers and to other Jews, and they go out and spread this stuff worldwide. Well, one of the ones who's spreading his doctrine is Margaret Mead. Under his direction, she writes Coming of Age in Samoa, in which she claims that they have this free love society in Samoa, and everyone is much better off than these crazy repressed American whites. White Christians. White Christians are repressed. They ought to be living like these Samoans. And the whole thing is utterly false. They tricked her. They had fun with her. Maybe she even knew that, but maybe she was just naive. But the point is that the Samoa she described did not actually exist. But the example of this bogus Samoa was used to undermine white morality, white Christian morality, by these Jews who promoted Margaret Mead. Again, why do they do it? Why do they promote these bogus claims about a promiscuous and successful society? Because they want to undermine white nations to make it better for Jews, make it better for Jewish predators, better for Jews to eat us, let Jews into their hotels, let Jews into their universities, get rid of anti-Semitism. How do we do that? We promote loose sex. How do we promote loose sex? Well, we use the new TV, and step by step, we show people being more promiscuous, but we also use the academic discipline to put out bogus theses that we claim support our view. Well, we know it's false, but we still claim it just the same. The Boasian school also had as one of its disciples at the University of Chicago, Lewis Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, who would go on to be extremely influential in the area of social engineering and housing. And Jones has books in which he writes about the destruction of ethnic parishes around major American cities like Detroit, Philadelphia, and Boston. Jones blames the WASP, but the WASP and the Jew working together to destroy ethnic parishes out of fear of Catholic political power. That's his little bugaboo and his hobby horse. We can see that Jews and secondarily WASPs are using these bogus theories to destroy the white race, not just white ethnic enclaves around major cities. Worthwood, and this is another important, always we see the Jew uses the false front, the front group, and creates the false flag to mislead and deceive his enemies, his racial enemies, so that they don't even recognize him as their enemy, let alone do anything about it. So this Jew, Lewis Wirth, would also go on to write at least 8 chapters of Gunnar Myrdal's The American Dilemma, which would serve as the theoretical justification of Brown versus School Board in the 1954 Supreme Court decision mandating school integration. So here we go. Now, I learned about this at college. I learned about The American Dilemma and this noble Swede writing about how America's screwed up on race and we really need to get right with the black folk. No one ever told me in my pricey private liberal arts, no one ever told me that Gunnar Myrdal book was actually mostly written by a goddamn kike. No one ever pointed that out. Here again, why do we pay for these college educations that teach us stuff that isn't true? What's the point in that? As always, the Jews put forward their agenda in either neutral terms, if they're doing it themselves, or they put it forward under someone else's name or someone else's race, to disguise their specifically Jewish ethnic interests in whatever the policy is. The Jew speaks to the voice of universal benevolence, but it's always what is good for Jews that's actually driving him, actually actuating him and motivating him. Never what's good for you. What's good for the Jew is always bad for the white and bad for the black. And all blacks and whites listening to me should understand that. Good for the Jew, bad for you. So, Jew Frankfurter twisting arms in the Supreme Court gets them to pass Brown versus School Board that gets the schools integrated. That is, it puts these feral 70 IQ monsters in with your white sons and daughters, and therefore prevents them from learning. And the intellectual basis of this political act of arm twisting,
why don't you use the American Dilemma as a pretext for making the political decision. I know that the law is settled and that separate but equal has been the rule for 50 years, but we need to discard that in light of new research, new sociology coming out of these important schools that we Jews have set up. And it shows that, you know, the problem with the blacks, race doesn't exist. You know, our own Franz Boas shows race doesn't exist. The reason blacks haven't achieved and there's this gap between them is the blacks haven't gotten as much money spent on them. They need to be put in with white kids. And, you know, you spend $10,000 a year on these blacks, they're gonna amaze you with some remarkable achievements. I really feel that.
And so this kind of garbage expostulating, no basis in precedent, lawmaking through the courts, backed up through media celebrations, rewrites the rules of the land and puts all of us whites at risk. And you know what? A few years ago, we went out to protest Brown versus Board of Education, and I mean, they did everything but shove mirrors up our assholes. They were very vicious, aggressive, rude. They would not let us demonstrate on the day that Bush was speaking there. And they basically allowed the opponents to come over and probably would have allowed them to start attacking us. They wouldn't let us go over there and speak to the public. They put us behind orange fences, but for the same reason that we're allowed to assemble was justified to prevent us from speaking directly to the public and to let the young, hostile antis under 18, less subject to criminal to the weight of criminal law, let them come over to our side and start messing with us. So the United States is a tyranny. It has the outward appearance of being free and allowing you to criticize, but the reality is you're only allowed to exercise those freedoms in very specific circumstances that effectively forbid you from getting your message out to the people who need to hear it. Now, Boas saw environmental sociology that it's not the niggers, it's the surroundings. The barrels, they're shooting at the gas barrels. Remember that in Steve Martin, The Jerk? Where he fails to grasp they're shooting at him? Well, that's the parallel here, is the Jews are saying, oh, it's not the black, it's the circumstance. He just didn't grow up in the right house. He just didn't have enough money. He just wasn't trained and raised right. Well, no. The problem is that the black itself doesn't have the capacity for civilization that whites has. That's why whites have always kept blacks segregated from white communities. Boas saw environmental sociology as part of the revolutionary tradition, which began with the French Revolution, which later found expression in the German Revolution of 1848. And that revolution failed and led to all kinds of socialists coming over here from Germany, many of them Jews and more of them not Jews, but too many of them having these bogus socialist nostrums in their cabezas, or their Köpfe in German. Boas, according to Friedem, was born in Minden, Westphalia, and grew up in a home where notions of liberty and equality, the ideals of the 1848 revolution in Germany, were still a living force. Like Otto Lee Assing, A-S-S-I-N-G, Boas found American soil more congenial to revolutionary ideas than his native Germany. After landing a teaching position at Columbia, Boas, with the backing of influential German Jews in New York, was able to launch the scientific, or I would say pseudo-scientific, attack on racism. In 1911, he wrote The Mind of Primitive Man, one of the books which helped establish the new field of anthropology, in which he wrote that the variations in cultural development can well be explained by a consideration of the general course of historical events without recourse to the theory of material differences of mental faculty in the different races. A similar error underlies the common assumption that the white race represents physically the highest type of man. Anatomical and physiological considerations do not support these views. So he's saying there's no inherent mental difference between niggers and whites, it's just how they were raised. He's saying this in a book, The Mind of Primitive Man, published in 1911. It was pure left-wing Hegelianism, which ran parallel to Marx's version of left-wing Hegelianism. Well, Jones says it was pure left-wing Hegelianism, which ran parallel to Marx's version of left-wing Hegelianism and became the inspiration for the NAACP policies every bit as much as Marx's theories became the inspiration for the Communist Party. Writing it around the same time when Madison Grant's book on race was a bestseller, Boas felt that the concept of race was inherently ambiguous. In an article entitled What is Race? Published in The Nation in 1925, The Nation is the left-wing publication, Boas rejected the idea that race consciousness and racial hatred reflected instinctual drives in human nature. So, Jews that come to this country, they set up their own academic disciplines, they buy the media, and for a time, they are able to put their views out, and regular whites are able to put their views out, and then they take enough power to where they can prevent the expression of white views. And this is evident even in the 1920s. Because I know from somewhere else that Madison Grant or Lothrop Stoddard, one of them said that already in that early decade, you could not get a word against Jewish racial lies published in France. So very quickly, they assume control of these media, and they decapitate the white race. They take its head away from it. They prevent the brains of the white race from speaking truthfully, honestly, and objectively about what's going on, because it would be bad for Jews. This takes a thousand forms, but the one we're discussing today is racial differences. Each race contained so many variations, argued Boas, that it was impossible to generalize about them. That, of course, is ridiculous. 1 year after its founding in 1910, Boas became active in the NAACP, writing one of its pamphlets. The Real Race Problem from the Point of View of Anthropology, 1910, that is, a year before his book. In the fall of 1933, Boas summoned a group of intellectuals to, quote, devise ways and means for effectively counteracting Nazi propaganda in the United States, and particularly Nazi racial theories. So this guy was indefatigable over the first 50 years, the first half of the 20th century, and he's doing everything he can to destroy the idea that race exists, and therefore destroy any basis for treating races differently by law, and therefore destroy any basis for protecting white communities from blacks. A few years later, Boas would try to dissuade W.E.B. Du Bois from traveling to Nazi Germany on a research grant. Eventually, Gunnar Myrdal would take Boas's ideas and incorporate them into his book, An American Dilemma, and that was published in the early 60s. Friedman claims that Myrdal was neither Jewish nor American, but even after indicating that Myrdal did not in fact write Dilemma, it was written by the Jew Lewis Wirth, he fails to tell us that people like University of Chicago sociologist Lewis Wirth, who wrote large sections of Dilemma, was both. And that Myrdal had been brought in to give credibility to what was largely a Jewish project. Because as Friedman himself points out, the scholarly critique of society that evolved into sociology had, like psychoanalysis, earned the reputation of being a Jewish science. So all these Jewish pseudosciences are created at the same time. Sociology, psychoanalysis, and social anthropology, as distinct from physical anthropology, which must be based in bone. Garvey arrived in Harlem before Boas's influence began to be felt. He arrived at the high tide of racial consciousness in America on the brink of America's involvement in the Great War and at the beginning of the greatest internal migration in American history, the movement of the former black slaves out of the agricultural regions of the South into the big cities of the North. The conditions for the emergence of racial consciousness among American Negroes was never more propitious. The migration out of the South would last for another 40 to 50 years and would redefine the race issue in America. Like the migration during and following World War II, two factors would play a role. Negroes wanted to escape Jim Crow or sharecropping. And secondly, the industrial North needed cheap labor to replace the millions of soldiers who had gone to Europe to fight in the Great War. And again, you had the Jews saying that they would ensure American participation in the war in exchange for against Germany. They're saying this to the British politicians in exchange for guarantees for Zionism and Palestine. So as they get America into the war, millions of white soldiers go off to fight in Europe, and then millions of blacks move out of the South up to the North. So they move from like Alabama to Detroit or to Chicago or to Gary, Indiana. Railroads and the wage differential did the rest, says Jones. Between 1916 and 1918, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 Southern Negroes headed north. Between 1910 and 1920, the number of Negroes living in Gary, Indiana, increased by more than 1,200%. Chicago's Negro population increased from 44,000 to 109,000 during the same decade, a rise of 150% at a time when the white population increased by only 21%. Now, I don't know if you've been out there, but Chicago is heavily black and about a quarter Hispanic. Everywhere around the lake, all the way through Indiana up into Michigan, there's all kinds of blacks around there. Chicago to Gary, Indiana, even over to Kalamazoo where we had the rally the other year. Lots of blacks up there. Before, most of the black population was located in the South, Mississippi, Alabama, and the Black Belt. But now it's more spread out as a result of the Jews getting us into wars and sending young white men off to fight them. This was the era before the imposition of immigration restriction, which began in 1924, an act that the Jews were very hostile to. They wanted the borders left open. And so many of the new black immigrants came, as Marcus Garvey did, from the Caribbean. They came to cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, and Boston. But New York, and Harlem in particular, was unique in both what it offered its black immigrants and the Negro culture it produced. It was in Harlem that the Negroes also met revolution in its modern form. And this gets back to Jones's thesis propounded in ad delightum in Libido Dominandi, that sexual revolution is the same thing as political revolution. It was in Harlem that the Negro also met revolution in its modern form. Many Negroes, Claude McKay, and he goes into him at length in Libido Dominandi, Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, and they're also covered, were attracted to communism. So you've got open borders, you've got blacks moving around as a result of the war, and they're looking for better jobs. But the main site of the new black culture is in Harlem, where you've got blacks coming in from all over the place, either American South or different parts of America, or from the Caribbean, and there they're meeting these Jewish communists and getting exposed for the first time to these Jewish revolutionary ideas. Many Negroes, Claude McKay, Langston Hughes, and Richard Wright, were attracted to communism, and it was primarily through exposure to New York's Jews that the Negro made contact with the various forms of revolutionary activity that were being promoted there. With Max Eastman, who was not Jewish, a non-Jew named Max Eastman, as his mentor, the Jamaican immigrant Claude McKay began working for The Masses, that was a communist magazine, where he ended up in a conflict, including a fist fight on the sidewalk outside the Masses' offices with Mike Gold, author of Jews Without Money. Unlike the other cities we have mentioned, New York's Harlem, which began turning black around 1905, and by 1930 had 328,000 blacks living there, had a sizable West Indian population, and this became the backbone of Garvey's UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association, movement. So, Harlem is white up till 1905. It becomes black. You got 330,000 blacks living there. You got a lot of West Indian blacks. Garvey is from the West Indies, from the Jamaica, and His Universal Negro Improvement Association is started in 1914, and the West Indians in Harlem are the backbone of it, is what Jones is saying, so that you understand the context. And also in this context, it's you have all kinds of millions of Eastern European Jews from Poland and Russia have come in here, and they're also promoting communism at this time. Eventually, Claude McKay was feted by Lenin in Russia in 1922 during the deliberations of the Third International as the symbol of Negro revolution in America. So, the Jewish gangsters who took over the Soviet Union came from the Lower East Side of New York, were bankrolled by Jewish money from the Jewish banksters and financiers, and they're celebrating the Negro that is going to be used by the Jews still in America to guarantee Jewish civil rights and to destroy white American ideals and destroy white American policies of separation and separate development. So you see how it all fits together. More often than not, Jews were the Negroes' mentors in the schools of revolutionary thought. A. Philip Randolph was introduced to the writings of Karl Marx by Morris Cohen, a young professor of philosophy at CCNY, an institution which would become a hotbed of revolutionary thought in the 1930s. Irving Kristol, father of neoconservatism, would listen in on heated political discussions in Alcove B, eating egg cream sandwiches for everybody, for the house. In Alcove B, they're discussing, they have a Trotskyite lunch table at CCNY, along with Daniel Bell and other Jewish thinkers, mainly sociologists who would go on to fame in the 1950s. So this type of Jew, and using the accent I'm mocking, or a meeting, is that they're little communist revolutionaries of a bunch of different sects, meeting at CCNY, because they haven't fully invaded the Ivy League yet, so the lower-end Jews are going to CCNY, and they're becoming sociologists and anthropologists and writers for the media, you know, TV script writers. So all these people, these Jews in New York, are creating and spreading these bogus doctrines. And using blacks to advance some of them. But it's in this milieu that also you have the black political people operating out of Harlem. So it's there's Jews and blacks, and there's a lot of ferment because a lot of these people are newly come to the U.S. and they're still trying to figure out what's going on and how they want to change it to fit their Jewish or black agenda. When Randolph, the black Randolph, went on to organize the sleeping car porters into the nation's first black union, he got help from Jewish union leaders as well as from Jewish politicians like Emanuel Seller, as well as financial help from uptown Jews like Herbert Lehman, and spiritual advice from activists like Rabbi Stephen Wise. He's the main Jew rabbi of the first 50 years of the 20th century. Emanuel Seller, you'll remember, is the Jew who's behind the 1965 Immigration Act that opened our borders to the Third World and reversed the 1924 Act the Jews hated so much. So the Jew communists are helping the blacks, because together they know it destroys the whites. Randolph's organization would go on to become one of the main pillars of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s when Bayard Rustin took it over. Friedman refers to Randolph and Rustin as keystones of the Black Jewish Labor Alliance. So a guy forms the first black union, and he works with Bayard Rustin, and they're working with the Jews promoting civil rights in the 50s and 60s. Well, this is the basis of it back in the teens and the 20s, back in Harlem. The third form of revolutionary activity being proposed to Harlem's black diaspora was the liberalism of the NAACP, represented by W.E.B. Du Bois, the Harvard-educated mulatto from Barrington, Massachusetts, who was the editor of The Crisis. Unlike all the other destinations chosen by the Negro migrants, Harlem was unique because of the opportunities it afforded. It was in Harlem more than any other northern city that the Negro met the Jew. During the 1920s, General Colin Powell's family migrated from Jamaica to Harlem, where he went to work for a Jewish shopkeeper and learned enough Yiddish to address Israel's prime minister in that language years later. Irving Lewis Horowitz, who grew up in Harlem, would later say that he spoke English like a black sharecropper. He also said that growing up in Harlem led him to his love of jazz, and And he goes into the main religion promoted by Jews was modernity. No one epitomized the new era of the northern Negro better than Harlem. Harlem was where the sharecropper met the modern world, which, as Yuri Slezkind has pointed out, was largely a Jewish creation. Slezkind's the author who written about Jews in the 20th century and has admitted to many of the facts that MacDonald brings up and many of the motives that MacDonald brings up in Culture of Critique. Let's take just a little break here. I'm a little bit tired of talking. I'll be back in a couple of minutes and we'll go a little bit more, and we're not going to finish this article today, and I still want to hit the other subject. And so we'll play a song. We'll do another little bit of analysis of this. We'll continue with the E. Michael Jones article on Marcus Garvey, and then we will go on to discussing rallies and legal matters and bringing people around, and that will wrap it up for the day. So I'll play one song right now. This will be Tenderness by General Public. All right, we're back. Radio Astina 21, and we're on Tuesday, August 19th, 2008. And we've been discussing E. Michael Jones's Culture Wars, an article on Marcus Garvey. We're going to talk a little more about that. That was General Public Tenderness. Extended Mix. I like that song. And we're just about to actually go into talking about how Jews used jazz, kind of in the way they use hip-hop today, to stir up, to niggerize the white public and accustom it to hearing noise as music, and in general, lowering cultural standards, which just in the way of lowering sexual standards with by promoting promiscuity and lowering racial standards by claiming race doesn't exist. The Jews used all this communist ferment to make America pliable to their demands and open America to be preyed on, essentially, just as a spider would inject digestive juices into its prey. Let them break down the tissue, make it easier to turn it into kind of an insect puree. That's what the Jews did to America, what the Jewish spider did to America soon after landing on its corpus. Now, because of Jewish influence, this is E. Michael Jones, because of Jewish influence in the theater and the press, Jews could promote their own vision of the Negro and ascribe to him a meaning that would undermine and eventually countermand the image which the South had been promoting in novels like Dixon's Klansman. So remember, you got the Civil War, you've got Reconstruction, and the whites of the sicko Northern whites have put the blacks in charge of the South. In response, the South creates the Ku Klux Klan to redeem its freedom and protect its women and its people. And this is largely accomplished by this period, and they've restored the status quo ante to a degree with Jim Crow and separatist doctrines. And so the Jews are coming into the country over the back end of this period from 1880 to 1920, and they're creating or owning the media, the newly created mass media, and they're going to use this to portray a different vision of the black, and essentially a politically correct vision of the black, and use it, you know, to browbeat the white. And we'll see. What Jones says is the so-called Harlem Renaissance was one of the better-known offspring of the meeting between Jews and Negroes, which took place in Harlem. If the Negro emerged as a cultural icon during the 1920s, it was largely because the Jews promoted him as such. And many thinkers, from Henry Ford to Harold Cruz, felt that the Jews never lost sight of their own ethnic self-interest when they created the New Negro Vogue. In quotation marks, New Negro Vogue. Henry Ford felt that the Jews promoted jazz to destroy America's native-born musical culture. Right, just like hip-hop, right? He felt the same way about the Jewish-dominated New York theater. Harold Cruz, writing at the other end of the political spectrum, felt that Jews, quote, sought to make themselves the interpreter of the Negro to American society. This took the form of patronizing Negro art forms like jazz and then colonizing them. Cruz, who spent most of the 1950s in a vain attempt to get one of his musicals produced on Broadway, felt that the Jewish take on Negro art was unmistakably clear. The original Negro jazz was puerile, shapeless, and chaotic. It was left up to Jewish musicians and composers to polish up this pristine black music and render it sophisticated enough for presentation to the general public. Interesting use, by, I might say parenthetically, of pristine there. People are used to associating pristine with virginal or pure, but it just means in its original state. That's why he's able to say pristine and then in the next breath talk about sophisticating it or shaping it up or improving it for the general audience. Oswald Garrison Villard, who could hardly be classified as occupying the same place in the political spectrum as Henry Ford, came remarkably close to Ford's conclusions when he, as the editor of The Nation, published an article on, quote, "The Jew in the American Theater," unquote. Recently forced out of his position as chairman of the NAACP by Joel Spingarn in collaboration with Dubois, Villard published an article which contemplated the fact that by 1923, American Jews had achieved domination of the theater as a corporate institution with mixed feelings. So Villard was head of the NAACP. The Jews kicked him out, and they installed Dubois as their black front man. And Villard, who's, you know, I'm not sure if he founded, but he's the main guy at The Nation, you know, that left-wing communist rag. And Villard is saying from the left what Ford is saying from the right: the Jews dominate the American theater. The rise of Jewish influence meant comparative neglect on the part of the Jew of the artistic in favor of the commercial factors of the theater. So Ford saying old musical, old theater ways are killed by the Jew who is looking to make a buck and doesn't care about the art involved. Murray Friedman viewed Jewish patronage of black artists and writers in a positive light, but the examples he cites, Amy Spingarns, the wife of Joel Spingarn, support of Langston Hughes, Joel Spingarn publishing Dubois at his newly created Harcourt Brayson World Publishing House, all indicate that supporting the arts was achieved at a price which both Cruz and David L. Lewis felt was too steep because the blacks contributed the raw aesthetic ingredients of the cultural vogue in music, dance, theater, and entertainment, but ended up on the short end of the material rewards, having no economic and corporate control over the vogue, which exercising an autonomously creative function that was less than negligible. So he's saying the Jews are basically ripping off black culture and selling it to whites. And the same thing they always accuse white rockers of: oh, your rock and roll is black and you're stealing the black man's music and all this. Well, this is what they were doing, essentially. They are packaging the blacks and using their art and music to make money while simultaneously reaping the political benefit of breaking down civilized white standards, dominating more of the economy, and working in conjunction with their brothers in overt politics to spread lies about race not existing. This is what Jews do. Everywhere. They follow the same patterns. They break down the morals and the standards of the host nation. To Cruz and Lewis, the Jewish patronage of black artists that characterized the Harlem Renaissance appears ambiguous at best. Instead of being a celebration of black culture, it was, quote, a diversionary tract intended to keep blacks away from Garveyism in favor of the milder legalism of the NAACP. So the Jews are misrepresenting blacks as whites equal while working for legal equality and presenting them as, you know, the culturally cool, just the way they do today. Music, art, dance, and the rest. And thereby distracting any attention they might give to Marcus Garvey, who wanted them to go back to Africa, make it on their own shift. Says Jones, the end of World War I created a revolutionary situation throughout Europe and the United States. Convinced that the success of the revolution in Russia was a prelude to its spread throughout the world, Lenin promoted successful revolutions in Hungary and Bavaria. It was only his defeat at the hands of Pilsudski and the Poles that prevented him from marching into Berlin for a triumphant union with the revolutionaries waiting for him there. Like we said, Russia, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. And these Jews were trying to Kurt Eisner down in Bavaria. These Jews are fomenting putches and revolutions, trying to communize the entire world and subject it to their brand of misery. The same revolutionary fervor soon spread to the United States, with Woodrow Wilson bedridden as a result of a stroke, dealing with the wave of unrest generated by the revolutions in Europe, fell into the hands of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. Mencken writes about him quite a bit. Whose raids exacerbated an already tense situation. As always in America, revolution and social unrest became compounded and confounded by that country's racial situation. The sight of Negroes in uniform sparked lynchings in Mississippi and elsewhere in the South. Once again, the South was haunted by fears of a Negro uprising, and the NAACP did its best to fan those fears, bringing about the lynching of a number of blacks. From the time they began in June 26, 1919, until they sputtered out in the fall, The race riots of the Red Summer of 1919 would claim the lives of 76 Negro men and women. So you've got the Reds, the Jews, who are the leaders of the communists, are fomenting revolution in Europe after World War I, and they're also doing the same thing in the U.S. You've got an incapacitated president, Woodrow Wilson, and his attorney general, A. Mitchell Palmer, is cracking down on the press and worrying about race riots. And in the Red Summer of 1919, you've got 76 blacks who were killed. The riots were not limited to the South. The worst race riot began in Chicago on July 27, 1919, when a black boy strayed into the all-white section of the beach at Lake Michigan and was drowned. Blacks roamed the city looking for revenge, and the whites retaliated with force of their own. In the crisis, Dubois fanned the flames of unrest by urging Negroes to prepare for white attacks by arming themselves. 1919, this is. During the entire summer of 1919, in fact, the crisis under Dubois's editorial leadership stoked the fires of Negro rage. Before long, the old vicious circle began to reassert itself in the South. Fear of uprising among the Negroes led to lynchings, which were then publicized by the NAACP, leading in turn to more fear of Negro uprisings in the South. The NAACP did nothing to break this cycle. If anything, their inflammatory reporting exacerbated the situation. Just as we saw with Elijah Lovejoy in Illinois in the 1830s and 40s, the sanctimonious madmen, or the Jews, are trying to incite the Negroes to attack the whites and thereby advance their political goals. In Georgia, we are told, a man was lynched because he was supposed to have said that the Negroes of Georgia were going to do what Negroes had done in Chicago. Lewis claims that Dubois and the NAACP were civil rights militants, not social revolutionaries, defenders of the Constitution, not exponents of class war, and like the association he sometimes unpredictably represented, the editor occasionally could appear exceedingly sensitive, if not squeamish, about charges of espousing political subversion and social unrest. Lewis bases his claim on statements which appeared after the government cracked down. The editor, he tells us, referring to Dubois, made it clear repeatedly that the Bolshevik Revolution was not, in his eyes, what it was in Asa Philip Randolph's, the greatest achievement of the 20th century. That's what Randolph said, and Dubois saying, no, we just want our equal rights. We demand equal rights, even though we're not equal. We're not communist revolutionaries. Kind of like what that Al Capone said. Don't get the idea, I'm one of these radicals. You know, he's a mobster, he's a criminal, but he's not a radical. Dubois would insist in a June 21, 1921 editorial, The Class Struggle, that we do not believe in revolution. We expect revolutionary changes to come mainly through reason, human sympathy, and the education of children, not by murder. Curbing revolution, Dubois continued, was being used as an excuse to deny Negroes freedom to think. The chief villain in this regard was J. Edgar Hoover, author of Radicalism and Sedition Among Negroes as reflected in their publications. High on Hoover's list of subversive publications was Dubois' Crisis, especially the issues which had come out before Dubois turned to the right in the wake of the Palmer raids. So the Attorney General is raiding the press, and he's raiding different people to suppress radicalism, whether it's actual radicalism or not. In fact, Dubois's crisis provided Palmer's Department of Justice with abundant and unambiguous evidence of sedition and conspiracy. Dubois wasn't alone in doing this at the NAACP. Joel Spingarn was, if anything, more committed to fanning the fears of Southerners and taking the war to Africa than Dubois. His statements urging the Negroes to arm themselves led not only to the new fighting spirit among the Negroes, but efforts to shut down the NAACP as well. So you've got the Jews at the NAACP, and they're trying to agitate and incite the Negroes against the South and the white man in general, just as they do today, except they're in a much more powerful position today than they were, you know, 90 years ago. In August 1919, the Attorney General of the state of Texas subpoenaed the books, papers, and correspondence of the Austin branch of the NAACP on the grounds that the NAACP was not chartered to do business in the state of Texas. In order to avert a precedent which could shut down the NAACP throughout the South, John Shalady of the national office wired Governor Hobby to ask for a meeting. Hobby referred Shalady to the Attorney General, but by the time he arrived in Austin, all Shalady could manage was a meeting with the state's acting Attorney General, during which he, quote, tried to explain that the NAACP was not engaged in organizing Negro uprisings against whites. On the morning following the meeting, Shalady was attacked and beaten by a group of 6 to 8 men, including a judge and a constable who freely admitted their part in the attack. Both men claimed that Shalady had come to Texas to incite insurrection among Texas's Negroes. Again, very much like the people of Alton, Illinois, who cashiered Elijah Lovejoy, who was trying to incite the Negroes to murder whites. White men must defend themselves, and word alone is not enough. When the NAACP demanded that Shalady's assailants be brought to trial, Governor Hobby sided with his assailants, writing that Shalady deserved the beating he had received by red-blooded white men who did not want Negro-loving white men in Texas. Very similar to Alton in Illinois. After administering the beating, Shalady's assailants informed him, "We attend to our own affairs down here and suggest that you do the same up there." 1 year later, Shalady, who never really recovered from his beating, resigned from his duties as the NAACP's executive officer. James Weldon Johnson later discovered that, quote, a prominent Negro clergyman of Austin had brought about the attack on Shalady by informing a Texas Ranger that the NAACP was banding together to excite sedition and race riots. This gives some indication that the NAACP's reputation as a revolutionary organization determined to foment uprisings among the Negroes of the South was not just limited to the white population. It was almost universal in the South and shared by many Southerners who were not white, so NAACP was seen as a radical group bent on exciting Negroes and producing a revolution. The trouble had begun in 1918 when the Justice Department warned the NAACP about the tone of its journal. Ignoring the Justice Department's warning, Dubois had written an article urging Negro soldiers to, quote, to marshal every ounce of brain and brawn to fight a sterner, longer, more unbending battle, against racism than they had fought against the Hun when they returned to the United States after the war was over. This was precisely what the South and large segments of the North feared, and this fear led the post office to impound the May 1919 issue of Crisis. And they were also impounding magazines mailed out by Mencken, although obviously not for the same reason. And he made fun of A. Mitchell Palmer and 100% Americans who hated, you know, people speaking German and what have you, and wanted to go to war for Britain. Even if they gave no reason for the action, it was clear to the NAACP board that they were following up on the threat from the Justice Department. That would be the post office impounding the issues of the magazine Crisis. The specter of returning Negro soldiers, now trained in the use of modern weaponry, was scary enough for both the North and the South. When that group was incited further by Dubois's prophecy that we are doomed eventually to fight for our rights, the situation became intolerable for moderates on the board like Oswald Villard, who severely criticized Dubois in The Nation, calling his opinion dangerous and mistaken, a counsel of madness that would lead nowhere but to bloodshed without results. Villard wasn't the only one who was horrified at the violent tone of the editorial. Representative James F. Burns of South Carolina held The Crisis and other Negro publications responsible for the race riots which had occurred during the summer of 1919 and demanded that the Justice Department look further into the matter to see if they had violated the Espionage Act by inciting Negroes to riot and take part in mob violence. So it's hot and heavy in the summer of 1919. You've got the NAACP, which is an organization controlled by Jews, using black men, usually mulattoes or quadroons, as fronts, namely W.E.B. Du Bois, that is inciting blacks to demand their rights or riot or produce a revolution or however far you want to you think it ought to go. The description of it, what he's doing. By the end of the summer, even the Negro press had joined in accusing the NAACP of promoting Bolshevism. Remember, a lot of blacks, they're not, we think of them, oh, they all vote liberal, they're Democrats, but stupid people are always conservative, and there's no one stupider on average than blacks. So they have to be incited, maybe not to commit individual acts of violence, but to act as a group for political goals. They have to be brainwashed, led, and told who to aim their fury at. Because otherwise they're going to be, you know, more naturally they're going to be Christians or they're going to be lazy or something else. and you won't see the organized violence that you do when the Jews, the Jew commies with megaphones are leading them. The purpose of the NAACP, according to Joseph C. Manning, a man who had led the fight against the disenfranchisement in the South, was to convert the Negro to socialism. The situation for the NAACP worsened considerably when Dean L.B. Moore of the Negro Howard University, that's a black university in Washington, D.C., claimed that a colored woman representing the National Association had advised colored men to go after what they wanted with a shotgun. The NAACP tried to finesse the issue by claiming in their 1919 convention in Cleveland that Bolshevism would become more and more attractive to American Negroes if the white establishment failed to implement the reforms which the NAACP was proposing. Villard sprang to the defense of the NAACP in The Crisis, claiming, "What the Negro now asked was merely good Americanism, not the doctrines of Bolshevists or anarchists, but that of the founders of the American Republic. But the damage had already been done. The NAACP was fixed in the minds of the establishment as a revolutionary organization." Attorney General Palmer claimed that, quote, "there was a well-concerted movement," unquote, among certain Negroes to become a, quote, "a determined and persistent source of radical opposition to the government and to the established rule of law and order," unquote. Palmer then made a thinly veiled reference to Dubois as holding degrees conferred by Harvard University and editor of a journal which was, quote, "always antagonistic to the white race and openly defiantly assertive of its own equality and superiority," unquote. Imagine having an attorney general that says something like that today. In April 1920, a crisis agent was beaten and sentenced to 6 months in jail after the state of Mississippi banned the sale of any magazine, quote, "tending to disturb relations between the races," unquote. Again, similar to Alton, this, where they destroyed Lovejoy's press four times. The situation in the North wasn't much better. The Lusk Committee of New York State denounced the crisis as dangerous and trying to involve the Negro in revolutionary radicalism. During this time of revolutionary ferment, Marcus Garvey continued to attract larger and larger crowds. Garvey, like virtually every other Negro leader in Harlem after World War I, had good things to say about revolution, especially if the revolutionaries were black. Garvey proudly recalled for his followers, though not always with complete accuracy, the stirring heroism of such leaders of American slave rebellions as Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, and Nat Turner, and the intrepid exploits of Toussaint Louverture against the French in Haiti were not neglected in the effort to make Negroes conscious and proud of their racial heritage. So, black nationalist Garvey is taking, a cue from the commies, and he's promoting his own agenda, but they're both promoting radicalism and blacks being proud and demanding their rights. Then in the summer of 1919, Garvey seized on an idea that would give symbolic but concrete form to the racial unity of the world's 400 million Negroes when he incorporated the Black Star Line on July 27, 1919. When a battered Canadian ship known as the Yarmouth, but soon to be rechristened as the SS Frederick Douglass, docked at the 135th Street Pier on September 14th, again, that's 1919, 5,000 cheering Negroes greeted its arrival as, quote, "one of the greatest events in the modern history of the Negro race." And we'll leave it right there on that for today. We will finish the article next time. So what we've seen is the three different schools of thought on how the blacks in America, which path they should take, self-reliance, back to Africa, or integration. We've seen how the Jews created and staffed with submissive Negroes, the NAACP, in order to make integration the only option. And, of course, they had to kill off the other two schools or destroy the leaders of the other two schools to make that the way. And they did. And then we've seen the demographic change as the blacks move from the South to the North, many of them, and the coming together of the black and the Jew in New York, in Harlem in particular, and the revolutionary ferment of the times. And we'll learn the rest of the story about what happened to Marcus Garvey next time. Now, we've been going about 3 hours now, and I want to stop here because I want to talk about some other stuff in relation to the forum. And Let me check my notes here. What I want to talk about is, first let me talk a little about the legal thread, and then I'll talk about rallies, and that will wrap it up. And let's see. What we've got here in general discussion, but eventually it's going to end up in Jews, the white family's worst enemy, is a recreation of our thread on documenting the Jewish domination of law school. Now, why is that important? It's important to know who dominates the law school because a lot of Congress is lawyers. Lawyers have a huge amount of power. They write the laws. And they're also appointed the judges who enforce and interpret the laws. And someone says, well, I tell people this, and, you know, they say, what difference does the guy's religion make? So how do you bring people around? Well, first let me describe the documentation, then I'll tell you how you bring them around. Documentation that we have, and Craig Cobb and I created a thread on this years ago that was unfortunately lost. We lost the whole This Just In section. And what we do is we go out and we look up the top 10 law schools. And as of a couple years ago, and I just copied this from what we had left, there still is one or two threads pertaining to this that are still up in addition to the new one I've created. But top 10 law schools a couple years ago were Yale, Stanford, Harvard, Columbia, NYU, University of Chicago, Berkeley, or Bolt Law School, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. And these top 10 set the agenda that the rest of the law schools follow. It's very much parallel to the way the New York Times and the Washington Post set the media agenda, and the rest follow them. TV just takes its stories out of the front page of the New York Times and shoots them with video. So now we go to these law schools, and every law school there, you can get a feel for the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, by looking at the people depicted on the websites of these different law schools. And you'll see that almost always it's 80% minority, or, you know, two-thirds minority, one-third white female, and then maybe one or two white males in the background. And they all have that same visual look. They don't look anything like the face of the America, in other words, as we use the leftist camp that is always used when to push things in the opposite direction, claim that whites are overrepresented. It's never used when whites are underrepresented. Anyway, you can go, each of these law schools has its own website. You can go there and look up the faculty. And then you can count the Jews. And even by conservative estimates, pretty much the lowest you'll ever find is that Jews are about a third of the professorate at these law schools. And often enough, they're even half. And we haven't gone back and redocumented all of this yet, but that's what you find, and this has a tremendously powerful effect, and it's very clear that these law schools are overtly discriminating against non-Jews. And they're obviously discriminating against white males in particular at these law schools, and this is something that is not enough has been made of. Because the lawyers and the power brokers in society, they're the ones, you know, your judges, lawyers, congressmen, I mean, a lot of that goes back to law school. It's a very litigious society anyway. And when these people are allowed to interpret laws, you have people who believe that non-Jews are animals who exist only to serve them, and yet these are the people running the law schools, teaching the next generation of lawyers, becoming the appointed judges, becoming the prosecutors, becoming the legal experts interviewed on TV. What kind of society are you going to end up with? Well, pretty much what you see today. So it's not a good thing. We have not finished this thread. We have merely restarted it. And I want to cite I'm going to read a question that someone had or an observation that someone had go into my thinking. Steve B. posted this in the legal thread. He says, this may not be very constructive, but when I try and point out the heavy infestation of Jews in top law schools, or any law schools for that matter, to friends, acquaintances, and family, I almost always get a patented response. What does their religion have to do with it? it's enough to make your average white nationalist go postal. Well, they don't understand that Judaism is not a religion. It's basically a hostile gang operating as a team to steal from the rest of us and oppress the rest of us. Then we have another guy, General Lee, says, that's exactly right, in response to Steve B. That is how your average white person conceptualizes Jews. White people with a funny slash quirky religion. It was only a few years ago that I saw them that way. I know how hard it is to wake up from that slumber. And worse, to the nigger-wise southern religious zealots, Jews are like a challenge from God. Souls just begging to be saved. That is the root of the love affair that southern Protestant churches have going on with the Jews. I had never encountered a Jew-wise person till I started reading Stormfront, then VNN. As radically racially conscious as my family was toward niggers, there was no one who understood the Jew underpinnings of the nigger menace, such as we've described earlier today. The Jews' best defensive weapon is their white appearance. There has to be a way to make the average Quan see through it. AmeriQuan. And I wrote, what if your worst enemy were given, this is all at vnnforum.com, you listening can join. What if your worst enemy were given godlike power to rule your life? Would that suck or what? How would you go about messing up society if that were your goal? What would you do? What kind of laws would you pass? Don't start with Jews, end with Jews. Meet them where they are, bring them back to the truth. And he said he wasn't following me, and I wrote, I said, lead them in a roundabout way. Don't start by asserting the fact that Jews dominate law schools, if that gets their back up, if that sort of observation. Leave the Jew out and get them to join you in discussing what domination means. In fact, don't even use that word. Get them to agree with you on something related to our decline. Talk about the symptoms. Then gradually lead them around to the cause. Prick their imagination. Get them to think about how they would go about destroying the country if that were their goal. What kind of policies would they pursue? What kind of laws would they make? How would they cover things in their media? And we've seen how they've done that with regard to race. It's the same thing. You say, the way that you bring someone around is start by getting them to agree with you something, not getting their back up in disagreement when you say Jew, because they've been taught that Jews are good people. Say, you know, do you think lawyers have a lot of power in this country? Everyone's going to agree with that. And then, okay, lawyers have a lot of power. And then say, you know, do you like the way things are going? You know, polls show most Americans don't like the way things are going. Use specific examples, affirmative action or, you know, endless foreign wars or open borders. And you know, whatever symptom of decline you want to use, you get them to agree that they recognize that symptom themselves. And then you say, well, you know, you have to get them to understand that lawyers have a lot of power. Lawyers have a lot of sway in setting up these rules that are leading to these symptoms of decline that you don't like. Now all you have to do is the final step of explaining to them that, yes, lawyers have a lot of power. Yes, what they're doing is negative. Now you have to see that these lawyers, upon closer inspection, are actually Jews. And they have a huge dominance in the top law schools that all the others follow from. Whose examples the others follow. And in this way, you teach them, boy, they may not accept it right off, or they may not show you that they accept it right off, but they will come around. If you do the job properly, that is slowly, degree by degree, and you draw out of them Socratically what they know, and you make it appear not that you were teaching them or telling them, but you're just more or less reminding them of what's already in there, as you pull it out of them through questioning. That's called the Socratic method, which is also used in law school, by the way. In that way, you teach them without appearing to teach them. You teach them by appearing to remind them. This is effective because most white males like to believe that they formulate their own opinions. They don't, actually. What they do is they read something they like, and they use it. And over a short period of time, they forget that it came from someone else, and they attribute it to themselves. I suspect this has a biological basis in needing to be the big dog to get the female, and that's why they're puffed up with the vanity of their own opinions and how great they are. It's got to be biological, because it psychologically echoes the puffing and strutting, you know, you see in a bird or any animal trying to display for the female. It has to be located in that, I would guess. It doesn't matter, because the effect is the same, but thus you reach them by, unless they're one of the minority that can handle direct criticism or direct logical connections laid out, bam, 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 you want to lead them by this roundabout way back to the truth that you know. And, you know, you can talk to them, and then you can give them, you know, a URL or a CD with what I'm saying right now, and then they can listen to that in private, and their ego won't be threatened by, you know, it's threatening to a grown male to accept that someone else is right and he's wrong. It's a little humiliating. We don't want to do it. We have our pride and our vanity tied up in that more than women do. And so you have to be careful in how you approach it. And once you're done, you know, you give them additional material. I mean, a lot of males like political analysis and discussion, and that's why we do this show, reach more and more people. We don't interrupt the show with advertising. My God, I don't even interrupt the show with music any longer. I used to run 5 or 6 songs in a row. Now it's just straight talk. And so I'll talk more about this thread once we complete it and we can run down the list. Right now, I haven't, I put the thread together and took the best of what remained after the fiasco that was the loss of that section. I put that back together, and we have lists of Jews from 2 of the top 10, but we want to get the other 8 and get about it that way. We'll talk more about that when it's done. But all these important subjects, we have sticky threads on at vnnforum.com. We encourage you to join our forum. It's for serious people writing under normal names. We don't have all that Klan and Nazi garbage. People who cause problems are either banned or stuck in the tard corral. Yes, we have a free-range tard corral. And the sane, self-controlled people are allowed to speak in the main forum. As it should be. Now, just checking the rest of that thread to see if... Okay. Now let's see here. There's one other article I wanted to talk about today, there's actually 2 things I want to talk about today. I'm going to talk a little about Kirksville now, and then I'm going to go back and talk about rallies and the Klan and the law and what we need to realize about that. And just because it's where I live and it's worth talking about, let's talk about Kirksville, Missouri, and what's been going on recently. We had on an earlier show the report that 3 niggers had come up from East St. Louis, and I guess they met a 4th here, and they had a little shootout in the parking lot of the McDonald's near where I live at like 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And I don't know if there were drugs involved or what, but it seems a pretty safe bet. And we traced these free-range animals and their liberation back to the sanctimonious madmen in 1830s Illinois, who were fought by my ancestor and by about 80% of the community, who did not want them there inciting Negroes and talking about loosing them as an act of morality. And we use the quotation from the father of modern conservatism, Edmund Burke. You know, if you're going to liberate someone, it ought to please you to discover what that thing liberated is going to do. You let niggers loose, they're going to go on rampages. That's what they do. It's not like they sit around reading books. Now, okay, this is Kirksville, northeastern Missouri, 17,000 people. What have we had happen here lately? Here's another thing that I don't even pay attention to local news very much, but every time I do, by God, there's more Mexicans in there. What do we have here? Another Kirksville drug bust. This is a news article dated August 12th. Picture of a Mexican. For the 2nd night in a row, we have an Adair County drug bust to tell you about. This one involves the sale of a controlled substance. The Adair County Sheriff's Department tells KTVO, that's the one TV station we have local, it's an ABC affiliate, a confidential informant was able to buy approximately 7 grams of coke from the accused. Charged in the case is 33-year-old Gualberto Najera. Gualberto, Gualberto Najera of Kirksville, ordinary-looking Mexican. Officials also obtained a search warrant for his residence where they found cocaine, meth, and a small amount of marijuana. Najera is charged with one count of sale of a controlled substance. He is being held on a $75,000 cash-only bond. The bust was made by a combined effort of the North Missouri Drug Task Force and Adair County Sheriff's Department with assistance from Kirksville Police. So, worst of every possible world. You've got insane, stupid drug laws, and you've got, you know, all kinds of money taken from taxpayers to set up all these drug task forces, and then you've got endless supply of these drugs still coming in from Mexico and the third world because they won't shut down the borders. It's just, it's no good on any front. And so we just see more and more of this stuff. And yet, the liberal cultists will denounce me as being a hater for talking about what diversity is doing to destroy Kirksville. No amount of evidence will get through to a liberal cultist. They have to be destroyed, and the sane people have to take over. And that wasn't the only Mexican who's been in the news. This other thing that happened up here is there's a woman who's like an administrator at the local jail. And guess what? She has like a Mexican boyfriend on and off, and they both like to get drunk, whatever. He comes home to her house at one point. I don't know if he was living there or not. She doesn't want to let him in. She ends up shooting him. And right now, it's a big deal whether they're going to prosecute her or not. And people are up in arms both ways, I guess. It's funny. Just on a side note, the one thing that got people out on the street here in Kirksville was people were protesting. We had like one of these, you know, rural development grants to put in like an 8-screen movie theater a few years ago. Why, I don't know, but that's how it works these days. All the money goes to Washington, and they parcel it out for pork barrel stuff like this. But anyway, a bunch of people out there protesting. I didn't see it. I just read the report afterward. They're protesting. Guess what they're protesting? They're protesting some movie in which they're calling Dobos retards. They don't want people using the term retard in this movie. And they've got people out in the street with signs. That is characteristic of middle America in 2008. But anyway, this other one. Now, here's the basic deal here. This guy comes up from Mexico. He goes over to Milan. It's spelled like Milan, but it's pronounced Milan. And they got a premium standard farm over there, so they pay like 9, 10, 11 bucks an hour. So for a guy from Mexico, that's a dream. And there's all kinds of Mexicans over there, 20, 30 miles from Kirksville. Well, somehow this guy takes up with this broad who is like a jail administrator here at the jail in Kirksville. And on again, off again, I guess, you know, they like to drink. He runs back and forth from her to some Mexican woman over in Milan. And anyway, the white woman, the mud shark, who's a jail administrator, winds up shooting him. Her blood alcohol is 0.12 4 hours after shooting him, so she was wasted off her ass. I don't know if you've ever blown a breathalyzer or whatever. 0.12 is fucking drunk. Pardon my French there. It's extremely drunk. And this is 4 hours after the event. She's blown a 1.2. Anyway, she blew him away, and she blew the 1.2 4 hours later, and they initially, I don't know, they under the castle doctrine that your home's your castle, they didn't prosecute her at first, but then just the other day they had some grand jury hearing in like 50 minutes. They said that she ought to be tried for felony murder, I guess. So it's a story it's hard not to have mixed feelings about. On the one hand, you got a mud shark who's probably a murderer. On the other hand, you got rid of a Mexican who's probably an illegal alien. So, but this is the kind of the decline that we're seeing. Kirksville is a lower middle class community, as these things are defined socioeconomically. And you start to see the breakdown, you know, the club, they play all that nigger shit, and the low end whites get into that, fat ugly white women get into that nigger shit, and then they wind up, there's always a nigger or two around, they wind up with mulatto bastards, and the misery spreads. This is what the NAACP intended to accomplish. And they have the program and the system well underway. And this is another example. You know, you let in the third world, you keep wage rates low, and your native white population begins to mix with the foreigners, creating an increasingly fat, stupid population. So here's a little clip from one of these articles. He's in an exclusive interview with the Kirksville Daily Express, Andrea Castillo, who is herself probably an illegal alien come to the U.S., said she first met this Mexican's name is Rogelio Johnson, of all things, R-O-G-E-L-I-O, Johnson. How he got that name, I have no idea. Anyway, this Mexican broad says she first met him in 2006 after he immigrated to the U.S. They both worked together at Premium Standard Farms over in Milan. And he was very kind with everybody. Castillo, who doesn't speak English, said through an interpreter, "You treat people with respect." Jackie Gleason, now she's the white broad in the question, a middle-aged white broad who's a jail administrator, whom Johnson had an on-again, off-again relationship with in Kirksville, said he physically and mentally abused her. Castillo, who lived with Johnson for a couple months at a time, said he never assaulted her. "When he got mad, he got very explosive," Castillo said. "He had his moments, and that's when he would leave the house." So he's running back and forth between these two broads. This is just characteristic of the disintegration of the times when you have open borders to the third world. Gleason shot a woman named Jackie Gleason. How weird is that? Jackie Gleason shot Johnson in her home May 9th after he allegedly threatened to kill her before raising his arms into the firing position. Of course, both of them were probably drunk off their ass. Gleason fired one shot from her 9mm revolver, striking Johnson in the chest. Adair County Coroner Brian No declared Johnson dead at the scene. Castillo said he never... These guys never get anything right in this... Oh, that's Arrear, who's a butthead in the local paper. Greg Arrear, dumbass. Castillo said she never saw a gun in Johnson's possession. She didn't even think he owned one. No gun was found at the scene of his death. Gleason also stated in an interview with Highway Patrol investigators she suspected Johnson had been or was using cocaine. Castillo again refuted that. "I never suspected nothing like that," she said, "but he did drink too much." We've had a Mexican stab another Mexican. That's one of like two or three murders in the last year. So, I mean, the minorities are maybe like 10-12% of the population, but they're committing basically half of the felonies, half of the violence. It really is pretty amazing. Yeah, so these jerks were drinking and fighting and whatever, and, you know, it's just the Mexicanization, the niggerization of Adair County is a thing disgusting to behold. You know, and they're just allowed to come in here and cause problems, and what the hell? This is, there's really nothing more I can say about it. It's just a report from one small town, and, you know, all these incidents. The niggers coming up from East St. Louis and shooting up in McDonald's, a house full of niggers busted for gun possession. They're all ex-felons. Niggers stabbing someone outside of Toons when the bar shut down. Another nigger raped a couple of white girls. I mean, Mexicans selling all kinds of drugs, teaming up with the local women, getting shot by them. I mean, this is what goes on with these scum populations, foisted on us by the Jews. Now, let's see. We'll leave that alone. I'm getting a little talked out here. I just want to hit one more topic, and we'll call it a day. And the topic I want to hit is rallies. I created the TARC rally, and some people are going after me, and someone started a threat attack me and mischaracterizing what I did. And his point, although I think he's an anti, just jerking my chain, his point is, oh, we shouldn't act like niggers. You shouldn't have jumped over that barrier and charged the antis, and we should have acted respectably and whatever. No, you don't get it at all. I didn't jump over anything. I didn't charge anybody. I walked down the middle of the street and positioned myself immediately opposite the mass of the public slash antis in order to jibe with them and talk to them. No one was under attack. No one was ever endangered except me when the cops jumped on me. And again, I'll note for about the third time, they allowed the sodomites in California to have sex in public, to mingle with the public, inside of a roped-off region, whereas at our rallies, they keep the public away from us. They allow other people to drone us out with microphones, and they keep us behind barriers locked in a very small space. Total hypocrisy. So the corporate and government and political powers that be are behind faggotry and against whites. Now, what I said was, for the first time, I said, what would have happened if the people we had at the rally, we had several dozen people, maybe 100 people, I don't know. What if, 50 of them had followed me? What would the cops have done? There would have had to have been a mass arrest, and even though they had hundreds of cops there, it still would have taken them a long time to haul everybody off and book them. It would have been a big hassle. It would have got us even more media coverage. My point is that those of you who think that political revolution or serious change is a picnic need to wise up. You got to put something on the line, even if it's as modest as simply, risking being arrested for walking down a public street. I didn't apply for a permit for that rally. I said I don't need one. I'm not a criminal. I'm going out there specifically to address the public in light of this horrific crime. I didn't say I'm going out there to suck some guy's cock or to masturbate out a window. I said I'm going out there to tell the public about a very serious problem we have and give it some of my suggestions for making it better. And I'm to be jumped on, and smashed into the asphalt for doing that while the fags can freely circulate. Well, disease-spreading fags copulate in public while I can't do that. I can't give my 2 cents in public. I have to be herded, I have to be wanded into a tiny little corner where no one can hear me, and searched. It's not right. But if no one follows me, I'm not a leader, so I'm leading myself. And I'm not saying what other people should do, I'm just saying what would happen if we had hundreds of people doing what I did. Oh, we shouldn't act like niggers. We should obey the rules and obey the authorities. Maybe you ought to pay more attention. Look at what's going on. You're helping them when you do what they want. We didn't ask them to protect us. We don't need protection from the public. The public agrees with us. They want to corral us so they can take shots of us looking like prisoners or deranged people or federal plants wearing Nazi shirts because it serves their agenda. To portray us as out-of-towners and freaks and people who have nothing in common with those who suffered the loss there in Knoxville. And will always be under duress and threat as long as Negroes are allowed to roam free. They want us behind bars. They want us in those little tiny enclosures, not having any weapons to defend ourselves, hardly able to be heard because the public is kept so far away. That's what they want. And it's especially ironic to be upbraided for acting the right way by someone who features a Klan avatar. If the Klan could have worked within the system, they wouldn't have been the Klan. It wouldn't have been created because there wouldn't have been a need for it. If people are enforcing laws that are oppressing you and leading to your genocide, you have every natural right to resist them. And if you won't even take the modest resistance of disobeying their command or their orders, and which in this case didn't even exist. They didn't even give me an order not to go there. I walked right past them, as Tony said, and no one said anything. It was only later where they hopped on me. If you're not even willing to go that far, then why even kid yourself that you're resisting at all? It's not a picnic, this stuff. It's not a spectator sport. But too many white nationalists see this as just another entertainment spectacle. Go out and listen to some guy make an angry rant. Have some beer and go home. I mean, what the hell? That's not it. It's not about that. You got to get a lot sharper, and that's why we're upgrading the form. We're getting rid of the dummies. Get rid of the people who can't spell because they can't pay attention to detail. That equals loser. Loser. We don't need losers. We need winners. Winners get things right every time. They get something wrong, they correct it. They say, thank you for pointing out where I'm wrong. We have to evolve. The feds have evolved a way of dealing with whites who resent the genocidal system enough to speak out against it, and their way is to put them in Ziploc bags. And they call that free speech. It allows them to keep their illusion that you can speak freely in public when you can't. You're drowned out, or you're kept too far away from the people who need to hear you. We have to evolve our tactics to get the advantages back on our side. And that's what I was trying to do. It's a little of what I was trying to do. You know, the Klan followed the law. Their women are being raped and murdered. They follow the law. The black governors, you know, appointed in Reconstruction, the black senators and who are allowed to oppress them, they allow that to happen? No, they went out and fought. They terrorized people. They killed them. They brought justice to the nigger rapists. They brought justice to the nigger criminals. They defended their people. We have to do the same thing. So maybe next time, more people ought to think about doing what I did. Because, seriously, I want you to sit back and I want you to think. If we had had 500 people at that rally, and 300 of them had followed someone doing what I did, what would have happened? Think that would have been better? I think it would have been a lot better. You get enough people, they have to take note of it. You get enough people, they aren't going to throw you in jail. They're going to lock you up for a couple hours and mass release you. Their system's already overburdened. The last thing it can handle is whites fighting back against it in any kind of organized way. You think about what makes them fear one unarmed, slowly walking white man walking down an open street. Why do they fear that so much? Why do they need to jump that guy and trip him and smash him? Why don't they say, hey, you want to go to jail? Why don't they say something modest? Why do they got to jump you and give you a hard time and choke you out? Why would they do something like that? Is it that threatening to them? Maybe it is. And if there's only one person doing it, then their job becomes pretty easy. There's dozens and dozens of people doing it. They have a hard time. Well, I say acting like that. Maybe whites need to act like niggers. How do niggers act when the cops are taking down one of their own? They get up there and they yell at them or they attack them. They don't allow it to happen. And the cops become intimidated. This stuff is animal. It's not about being right or being reasonable, as is the conceit of some. Oh, I'm going to prove you that I'm more gentlemanly. You don't win by being more gentlemanly than the opposition when the opposition is not made up of gentlemen. Do you think Jews like Seth Green or Murray Rothstein, do you think they recognize the stand? Oh, we had to give them their way. They're very gentlemanly, those whites. You think niggers recognize the standard of the gentleman? They're not capable of being gentlemen. Jews can't be gentlemen any more than niggers can. So why do you propose reasoned discourse and gentlemanly behavior as the standard? We don't set the standard. Our enemies set the standard. They control the high points. They are terrorizing us. The standard they set up is physical violence and lying. Those are what they use to defeat us and oppress us. How do we fight back? By being reasonable, telling the truth, providing the data? We have all that. We've had that for 100 years. We have to get physical and violent with them. We have to lie and deceive and cheat them. Maybe we'll become maybe we need to become monsters. But monsters who always have a capacity for civilization, latent. Always there waiting to come out as soon as we regain control of our lands. Till then, I don't want to hear any, oh, we're going to be good little sheep and go in our enclosure and do what they say. You need to get less fetishistically involved with law enforcement. Law enforcement is not on your side. They're not your friends. They are on the side of the system that pays them. And that needs to be understood. And you conduct your operations in light of that fact. We've seen today the Jews got their way by lying, by using, by deceiving, even by murdering or inciting to murder. And now they control things. And the scale of the lying and the murdering is a couple orders of magnitude greater than in the time period we discussed. And yet the lies and the murders go completely uncovered, except by us. The system set up to oppress us, the system set up to conduce to our genocide, then obeying the law is no virtue. And friends, that's going to be the concluding thought for today. I will return next Tuesday. We will finish the history of Marcus Garvey and Back to Africa black nationalism as co-opted / crushed by the organized Jews who set up and operated the NAACP. We'll conclude that next Tuesday, and I'll update you on anything else related to the forum or Sam Shepard. And let me say in conclusion, I'd like to urge you guys again to write to Simon Shepard, write to Stephen Whittle, express your support for the brilliance of their writings and the injustice of their martyrdom by the British government and the Americans who, as of yet, aren't doing anything to help them. Now, I'm going to take my leave of you. I will play the same song as I played coming in, and we'll let that run for about 40 minutes. I know my top-rate archivist, I'd like to thank him. I'm going to leave him nameless just because I don't want anyone messing with him. He's a good guy. I think Varg was also attempting to tape this today, and it does appear to me, as I have not seen the pop-up that has plagued nearly every broadcast I've done, we've got that problem solved, so thanks to Varg for solving that. We'll leave it right at the 3.5 hour mark. I'm going to play about, I don't know, 40 minutes of music. I might pop a little more on there. We'll just see. But I thank you for listening. I encourage you to visit and join VNN Forum at vnnforum.com. And I encourage you to copy this onto CDs and pass them out to people, or at least pass out the URL. All the shows that I do are archived, and they're all listed at vnnforum.com and at govnn.com. And they make great MP3s. If you're traveling on the road, vacation or something, they're great to listen to. They make time pass by pretty quickly. And once again, thanks for listening today. I'm Alex Linder, and that's enough.
Pyramids along the Nile, watch the sunrise from the tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while you belong to me. See the marketplace in Orlando. Send me photographs and souvenirs. And just remember, when a dream appears, you belong to me. And I'll be so alone without you. Maybe you'll be lonesome too. Fly the ocean in a silver plane. See the jungle when it's wet with rain. And just remember, tell your home again, you belong to me. so long without you. Maybe you'll be lonesome too. Fly the ocean in a silver plane. See the jungle when it's wet with rain. Just remember to your home.